I'd like to call the meeting of Boating and Waterways to order. Normally, our first order of business would be the Pledge of Allegiance, but we do not have a flag at this facility to do so. So with that, I'd like Charlie to call the roll, please.
Good morning, Executive Staff and Commission. Commissioner Brian Cooley?
Here.
Commissioner Cooley here. Commissioner David Livingston?
Here.
Commissioner David Livingston here. Commissioner Virginia Moreno?
Here.
Commissioner Virginia Moreno here. Commissioner Douglas Metz? Commissioner Douglas Metz absent. Commissioner Frank Peralta?
Here.
Commissioner Frank Peralta here. Vice Chair Catherine Pettibone?
Catherine will be here later.
Okay, she'll be late. Okay. And then Chairman Randy Short.
I am here as well.
Chairman Randy Short here.
Thank you. I'd like at this time to introduce staff. First, the Director of California Parks and Recreation, Lisa Mongat. And I take it Liz will be here, okay? And Acting Deputy Director of Boating and Waterways, Ramona Fernandez. And next to her, Catherine Tobias, who is our legal counsel, who always keeps me on the straight and narrow, thankfully. It's a hard job she has. There are comment cards, and for anyone in the public that wishes to speak, the green public comment card is for items that are on the agenda, and the blue comment card is for items that are non-agenda items. So if you would fill those out and get those to Charlie, I would appreciate that. With that, I'll move on to the chairman's report. I would like to say that it is hard for me to believe that it's time to leave my responsibilities as chairman. And as I've said before, it has been a great honor to have been selected by this commission to lead. I have the greatest respect and am in awe of the background, experience, and expertise of these individuals that I sit beside. The Boaters of California are well represented by these ladies and gentlemen. I feel like I leave with still so much to do, and given the opportunity, I will still serve and try to continue to lend a hand in what I believe to be the most challenging times for boating. And I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity you've given me as chairman. We will have elections at the end of the end of our meeting. With that, we'll move on to commissioner activities update. Any commissioners would like to update? Commissioner Peralta.
Yes, I'd like to advise everybody that the Shelter Island project, the $9.6 million 10-lane boat launch, is completed and being well used in the city of San Diego. They doubled their front dock for pedestrian traffic and put new modern lights and signs, and they also have ADA access, and the project is complete. It's been going on for the last 3 or 4 years, and that's my report.
Thank you. Any other commissioner comments? Commissioner Madueño.
Good morning, everybody, and to our chair, thank you so much for your leadership, for your passion, and all of the wisdom that you have brought for the last couple of years. You will be a hard act to follow, so thank you so very, very much for that. Just a couple of updates with regard to, I guess, the the work that I do, I guess, in my community. There's these things called opportunity zones that have been created by the federal government, and now each state in our country is given certain opportunities to be able to bring some of these opportunity zones through census tracts to reinvest in California's most disenfranchised communities. And so I'm actually looking to see if we can actually utilize some of these opportunity zones and some of the funding that is going to be allocated with these opportunity zones, where we can create some possible partnerships with the Division of Boating and Waterways to expand more public access points on our rivers, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, that would create, again, hubs for more economic development, job creation, and a better quality of life. So I'm hoping to bring an update to you at the next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Medrano. Welcome, Commissioner Pettibone. The next is the... I see that the Chief Deputy Director, Liz McGurk, is here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Next is the director's report, Director Lisa Mangan.
Good morning, everyone. You know, for us, this is a very special hearing. For one, it's our first hearing of 2019, so thanks for everyone for showing up and engaging. We're looking forward to a really exciting year in 2018? I did say 2008. Someone gave me the thumbs up. Thank you. Thank you. and a lot of things have happened. So just kind of in terms of situational awareness in the state of California, as we all know, we have a new governor, new leadership. Governor Gavin Newsom, as you've seen, very engaged, very focused on, you know, many initiatives, very excited to be our new governor. We also have a new Secretary of Natural Resources. So Secretary Laird, you may recall, was our prior secretary. Secretary Laird just announced his candidacy for California State Senate. Secretary Wade Crowfoot is not new to state government. He actually served for quite some time under Governor Brown, and I have to tell you, one of my first meetings with him, he brought up the R word, recreation, which is really important for us and really flagged for me that I'm going to have a lot less work to do, kind of talking to a new person and reminding them that California, the Department of Recreation, is not just about redwood forests. And so just know that he has sent a strong signal that he recognized that preservation and the great outdoors, that the human interactions and making sure that that's supported across California is going to be really important to him. So that's something that makes us very pleased and excited about the future. Today, while it's going to be probably one of our shorter meetings, I might actually offer that it's probably going to be one of our more significant ones. One reason is because we've asked actually our Deputy Director of Administration, Will Schaafsma, in the second row here. No pressure, Will. But I've asked him to come and really kind of share with you a really thoughtful discussion about our funding and how it is that we fund these programs. It's been, when we first talked about how we restructure our organization, we did public engagement meetings, and it was an occurring theme when we worked with stakeholders and when we were before the public, is kind of questions about how these activities are funded. Commissioner Randy Short and the commissioners themselves have really stressed that they too wanted to have a better understanding of these things. So in the past, you primarily had our Division of Boating and Waterways staff talking to you about that, but I've asked Will Schaafsma to come and lend his expertise to this. Will is, we have had him working on various parks priorities, and he has done a phenomenal job on helping us better communicate how funds are being used in other areas in the department. And I actually credit him for creating a new budgeting tool that we're also using called service-based budgeting, and it's really helped us be successful articulating what investments in our programs can yield visitors and users when we talk to decision makers who make those tough decisions about our budgets. And the legislature was so pleased with it, they're actually having other departments model that. So I'm looking forward to him providing that presentation today. Also, he is not alone in this. We are also working very closely with the governor's fiscal advisors, the Department of Finance, as we go through this top-down review. So I think that that's an exciting opportunity. Another really important thing that's going to happen later on today at 3 o'clock is that there's going to be our hearing and the discussion about our California voter card. We've heard from many of you, and I want to acknowledge that, so know that you are being heard. And when we have these hearings and we put out our proposal, it's just that. It's a proposal. So there are still conversations to be had. Please, though, make sure that you engage and make sure that we have an understanding of what's important to you on that piece. And we've met with several of you, so keep that conversation going. Where you could also be helpful is if you really want to be elegant about it, is not just suggest maybe what are things that you may have concerns about, but maybe if you were to talk to me, I very quickly ask you, well, what would you like to see? And I think that that helps even further the conversation. So thank you for recognizing that it's a priority and taking a seat at the table in that conversation. And then lastly, I probably would share with you a couple of teaching moments that happened. So one thing I would say, at the Parks and Rec Commission meeting that happened a few weeks ago, an OHV, one of our partners in the OHV community, who shows up to those commission meetings periodically, came and spoke and reminded us that people need to remember that these activities are fun. And I know that the chair, Randy Short, we have spoken about this here, that we speak so much about regulations, safety, and we've kind of joked about how government can just take the sense of fun just about anything. And if you can make boating feel like it's not fun, then leave that to government to be able to do that. But she delivered that message, and so I thought of you and this community. So know that you have a lot of support out there across other recreational groups. And then lastly, I'll tell you, over the holidays, I don't know about you, but you have some learning moments, and I had one from a group of my little niece and nephew and my daughter, who's 17, who's always teaching me things, but mostly about attire. I was talking to my dad about how we're have this recruitment campaign going. We're hiring about 360 new positions across the state of California to better to support the department and recreation. And we talked about that we had launched a big recruitment campaign and the challenge of reaching communities and making sure that we're pulling in talent into the organization. And so my little niece in elementary school, she said, so what is the department? And I said, well, it's the Department of Parks and Recreation. And she said, well, what does recreation mean? So I explained what it meant and the word fun came up. And my little nephew, who's even younger, said, well, why don't you just say that? And so my daughter said, you know what, if you just called it the Department of Parks and Fun, you probably could have saved a lot of money on fancy consultants. And you know what, she was probably right. I was just like, you guys don't get it. But then I thought, or maybe they do, right? So anyway, with that, we look forward to this meeting, and we hope to hear a lot of you from public comment, too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Mangert. I'd also, since Liz McGurk is here, I would like to express my appreciation for all the time you spent with us in our workshops yesterday. I think we had some very positive discussions, and I think I think at least from my perspective, I certainly learned a lot, and hopefully we can go on from there. But thank you for your time yesterday. I think that was very helpful. With that, I'd like to move on to the Deputy Director's report, Ramona Fernandez.
So good morning, everyone. So my division update will be brief today. Some of the highlights or some of the photos you're going to see is of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, which we had the privilege to visit and tour yesterday. So I just kind of wanted to highlight the Delta area. And I do want to take this time also to thank our Director Mongat and Chief Deputy Director McGurk, and also our administrative deputy director, Will, and the rest of the executive team for their continued support with the division. So I know the big discussion has been on the boater facility needs assessment report. So the division started this several years back. We had contracted with the California State University, Sacramento. They were to survey existing facilities and prepare the final report. So I am happy to announce that the report is complete. We are in the review process internally, and so Charlie Hesse, who is our staff person that's managing this, will be disseminating this to the division's management team as well as the commission ad hoc that helped assist with reviewing the process several months back. So once that happens, the document will then go on to our executive level for final approval, and then the document will be made available on our website, and we will be also publishing several copies of it. Our recreational boating safety grant funding that we receive every year through the U.S. Coast Guard, the division has received our allocation from the Coast Guard for our federal fiscal year 2019. We will receive approximately $5.7 million to support our recreational boating safety programs. So as a reminder to everyone, this funding helps support our multimedia campaign, education and outreach programs, our accident reporting program, the Aquatic Center, law enforcement equipment grants and training, as well as assist administrative costs for to support staff travel to events, engagements relating to recreational boating safety. Regulations. The division, as Director Mongat mentioned on the California Boater Card, the division is in the process of promulgating regulations. As we all know, this is our newest program. Implementation started 2018 of the first phase. Our public hearing for this rulemaking process will be held today at 3 o'clock at One Capitol Mall, which is just right across in Old Sacramento at our headquarter office. We're also in the review process for amending regulations for our quagga zebra and mussel prevention grant program. And the division has also identified other programs that will require amendments to our regulations. And so I will be continuing to update the commission on those programs and progress. The department's audit office is also in the process of auditing all of the department's grant programs. And we are really pleased that DBW will be now part of that process. And so our grant programs are scheduled to be audited this year as well. So this will be a perfect time for us to, you know, identify areas where we can improve. It is an internal audit within our department. We have our own audit office. So we really are pleased that we can now be part of that process. We talked about the multimedia campaign and awareness, safety awareness. This next year, we are really pleased that this campaign will now be be developed and increase brand awareness for our department in its entirety. So what does that mean? DBW will be leading because we've been managing this campaign and the safety awareness for many years. So DBW will be the lead on that, and we'll be working with our boating partners. So in one area, one of our boating partners this year will be the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation, which is running a statewide campaign targeting new boaters in California, and that messaging will be in both English and Spanish. We anticipate an executed contract sometime in March, and a DBW's will be advertising, an outreach planning for the 2019 messaging will begin our development in April. So, the campaign. This year, our campaign is managed through our communication and marketing division under the leadership of the deputy director, Gloria Sandoval. And as most of you know, that she was a prior DBW staff person, so we're really glad about that. Our 2019 statewide events have already began, with us participating in a boat show in Southern California and also the International Sportsman's Expo in January. Events will continue to include partnership meetings, boat shows, boat events, marina outreach, and local events where there'll be heavy presence of boaters. And you'll hear more on the California Boater Card specific efforts on a separate presentation later on in this agenda. Department reorg. So yesterday we had a good conversation at our workshop regarding the department's reorg and where we are. So I just want to kind of summarize a couple key points from that workshop. As was mentioned, boating and waterways will remain the policy, will remain the policies for all of boating programs. Boating will continue to manage the Harbors and Watercraft Fund. And program staff that are transferring to other parts of or other divisions will continue to participate in boating-related events, conferences, meetings, and also at commission meetings. We will have one cohesive grant management program, and that will be huge, I believe, for the division. All of our grants will be under one leadership, and that manager will also be working closely with office or other divisions that have grant programs. Communication will be key in this transition, so there'll be constant communication with those divisions that will have now boating components. And that completes my report, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to the budget report, and look forward to hearing from Will, since he deflected some of my, maybe it was Chief Deputy McGurk that deflected some of my questions from yesterday's workshop to today. So look forward to your report there, Will.
Mongit for the gracious and possibly undeserved introduction there. So we have a we have a budget report this morning, and I think the PowerPoint is still loading here. But I'll just kind of quickly go over what we're going to talk about this morning on the budget. So it is focused on the 1920 governor's budget. I guess do I have to click here to get the? We have a PowerPoint for. Nope. There it is. Thank you. So what I wanted to cover today was focus on the Jan 10, 1920 governor's budget, in particular the Division of Boating and Waterways. And what we'll discuss is the overall funding for the division, go over quickly how many positions the division is receiving this year or receiving authority for. What fund sources the division receives, quickly go through some capital outlay proposals in the budget this year, and then have a brief discussion on revenues and expenditures and take a longer look at what expenditures and revenues have done over the past 10-plus years. So with that, I think I'll just get into the presentation. So in the Jan 10 budget, we have essentially three lines for Division of Budding Waterways. The first is state operations. And what state operations is that's your staffing and your operating expenses and equipment. So that pays for all the Division of Budding Waterways staff, as well as the staff that grants out the local assistance monies. This year we have $36.7 million for state ops for Division of Budding Waterways. It's essentially unchanged from last year's budget. We have $21 million in Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund, almost $8 million in federal trust funds, $6.5 million in reimbursements, and $1 million in vessel operator certification account funds. Positions for DBW this year is 57.3, and that's the same as it was last year. Similar to state operations, we have a essentially unchanged amount for local assistance. That's $47.2 million, 21 of which are coming from the Harbors and Watercraft Recreation Fund for boating facilities. We have federal trust funds that support equipment and aquatic center grants in the amount of $12 million. Another $11.5 million from Harbors and Watercraft for boating operations, and $2.8 million in abandoned watercraft abatement funds. That's similar to last year's. We increased a couple years ago from 1.75 up to 2.8 in that program. And then lastly, we have $3 million for capital outlay, and I'll just quickly talk about what projects that funds. We have three this year. No new support proposals, no new BCPs for any state operations staff. The only new proposals are for capital outlay this year. The first proposal we have for cap outlay is the San Luis Reservoir. This is for a boat replacement and parking improvements. This is actually a construction phase, so we should begin putting a new facility in place this year. That's $1.7 million Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. What this project's going to do is it's going to widen the existing two-lane boat ramp by two lanes at a third boarding float, and it will reconfigure the parking lot. It also upgrades some fishing cleaning and parking lot lighting systems. The next proposal we have is for the Lake Del Vi boat ramp replacement project. That's $940,000 Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. This is going to replace the existing boat ramp. The existing boat ramp is over 40 years old and is asphalt and becomes slippery when algae or frost is present. So that is a needed replacement. I believe this is planning monies, and that should commence this year as well. And the final capital outlay project is for the Colusa-Sacramento River. These are for boat launch plans. That's $397,000 Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. These are also for plans, redesigns and improves existing boating support facilities in anticipation of a new boat ramp. It also installs new utilities, roads, and multi-use paths. This replaces and relocates and improves camping facilities and day use area. So that's just our three cap outlay proposals we have in the budget, and now I'll get into some of the expenditures and revenue from the 1920 governor's budget.
Well,
yes.
Perhaps can I just offer very quickly? So I don't want to, we live in this world, so I don't want to assume that everybody understands kind of California's budget process. So every year the governor presents his budget proposal on January 10th. So these proposals that we'll just walk through were all of the proposals part of the January 10 budget. Those are now public and being and under consideration by the legislature, both the Senate and the Assembly. Going forward, we will be having, there's lots of staff meetings that will occur, and then also there will be a public hearing that both the Senate and the Assembly in their individual hearings will determine which issues they want to hear. Just because it's in the budget doesn't mean that they're going to hear it. They only pick the things that they really kind of are of significance that they may have questions. And then as we go through this whole budget consideration and all of the discussions, they'll come together as two houses and send a budget bill to the governor. So everything, you know, projections going forward and projecting success would be that all of these things would be in a budget to take effect on July 1st.
Thank you, Lisa. So the next slide here represents our three-year expenditures in the Jan 10 budget. We always display 3 years of expenditures. We have 17-18, what we call past year, 18-19 would be current year, and 19-20, of course, is the budget year. In this year's budget, we actually show our appropriation at each level. Typically, what will happen is 17-18 would represent your actual expenditures for past year. However, this year's budget is a little different with Fiscal. We are showing just our appropriation. And Fiscal is our new accounting system, so we're working out a couple bugs there. So one of those is evident in the governor's budget this year. You see the appropriation for past year instead of the actual expenditures. So you see three lines here. The top line is your local assistance. That's your grants. Your middle line is state operation. That's your staff. And then your bottom line is capital outlay. And what you see here is essentially we've been fairly flat in capital outlay and local assistance. You do see a bump in state operations. That represents $6.5 million that we're receiving in reimbursement authority from the Department of Water Resources. And that's actually paid for by the State Water Project. And what that money does is it's going to provide DBW with additional money to work on fish habitat. Again, not funded from Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. That's coming from water contractors, so no impact to the fund there. Fed funds and HWRF, Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund, that support the division staff have remained flat over the past 3 years. So we're not impacting the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund with new monies for state operations or staff. And a few slides will kind of talk about what our expenditures and revenues for that fund have looked like over the past 10-plus years. But in kind of recognition of the revenues and expenditures, we have remained fairly flat in state operations and local assistance. Commissioner?
Well, if I might, just because I probably don't have a memory that can remember all this stuff as we go forward, the water resources, is that Davis-Dulwig? Is that what that money...
That is a different set of funding. That is Davis-Dulwig. We provide $10 million annually to pay for recreation on state water project facilities through Davis-Dulwig. That money comes directly out of Arbors and Watercraft, and I believe that funding started in 2013-14. This is also state water project related. The funding is coming directly from the contractors, and this is to pay for fish habitat, likely as some requirement of the state water project.
Thanks.
So cap outlay, when you track that back, you know, over the past 10 years, it's fairly flat. We vacillate between $1 and $5 million a year on cap outlay projects, just depending on where we are in various states of these projects. So last 3 years, pretty much status quo for governor's budget for DBW. As far as expenditures go. So this next slide represents our revenues. And what you'll see when you look at DBW's budget, for revenues, every year we're going to see a dip in the even numbered years, and that's because we collect vessel registration in the odd years. So this governor's budget is no different. We see about $27 million in 17-18 and 19-20, representing the collection of those vessel registration fees. In 18-19, we just have the licenses collected, and that's about $5 million. Our interest income has been steady for the past several years at about $5 million. That represents the private and public loan interest that we discussed yesterday in the workshop. And then our third major source of revenue for Harbors and Watercraft is our motor vehicle fuel account transfers, and that represents the 18-cent excise tax that is charged on gas that is associated with boating use in California. So those numbers typically have been between $25 and $30 million. We are seeing a slight decrease in 18-19 and 19-20 associated with those fuel numbers that we are talking to finance about currently and trying to understand those numbers a little bit better. Commissioner.
If I might. I'm looking at the fund condition statement, and in there related to the Department of Motor Vehicles, I show that we have a spike, which makes sense every other year, but that we still pay, at least according to this, $2.4 million to the Department of Motor Vehicles in the off years, and in $5.3 million in the year that we collect that money. Do you have a reason, an understanding of why we paid the Department of Motor Vehicles that much money in the off season?
I think there's a base level of staffing that is supported through the program, but we are working with finance to understand those numbers better. I can tell you that when you track back the Department of Motor Vehicles expenditures over several years, the percentage that we pay in the down years has been fairly consistent with previous budgets for this year's budget. That is something we are working with Department of Finance, and they are working with DMV to understand better. There's no abnormality in this year's budget associated with those spendings, but the percentage is higher in the down years than it is in the up years associated with DMV costs. And my understanding is there is a base level of support in order to collect fees and licenses even in the off years. So you're going to see some bare minimum level of support for DMV in those years as well.
That bare minimum's pretty substantial.
And Mr. Chair, I think what I would offer is, so why is it important that the Department of Finance is part of this review, right? I think for most folks don't really understand kind of what Department of Finance does. You know, that they think that they're accountants. They're not. They're establishing policy for the state too. All of these departments that receive transfers from this fund, they don't report to us, but they do report up through the Department of Finance. The Department of Finance as an organization oversees all of their budgets. So it's very meaningful when these recipient departments, if we ask, send out questions to them and ask for reports related to these funds, it's a very different question coming from a control agency that advises the governor on budget policy and not just the math of it, but laws that govern how these transfers work. So those questions are, you know, it's a very different question coming from that level. So as Will's talking today and you hear about all the different transfers that we've all kind of collectively discussed over time, they've come into statute over many, many years, and the Department of Finance is looking at all of them and kind of making sure that there's a nexus, that there's an understanding, and so I think you're going to be able to get much of that information through the same effort.
Thank you.
So this next slide represents 10-plus years of resources and expenditures for the DBW program. And initially, I just wanted to look back 10 years, but I thought it was important to start with 8 and 9, and I'll get into that in a minute. But in order to fully kind of understand where we are today, I think you need to take a historical look at the program, and perhaps 10 years isn't even long enough to take a look back, especially given some of the conversation that was had yesterday around the loan program. So that is something I will be embarking on, as well as a longer look at revenues and expenditures for DBW. But I think the 10-year look gives us a good sense of where we've been, you know, under current economic conditions. Things are relatively stable since the recession. So I think this can shed some light on how the fund has gotten to the position it is today and some of the choices we've made with the program that have resulted in the fund condition statement balance that you alluded to, I think, earlier and yesterday. But what I'll kind of caveat is this represents expenditures from not only the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund, but also from the Federal Trust Fund, from the Abandoned Watercraft and Abatement Fund, from the Public Beach Restoration Fund, the reimbursements we receive for the program, and also expenditures that other departments make out of the Harbors and Watercraft Fund. The major expenditures being from DMV, Fish and Wildlife, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And those latter two mostly associated with aquatic invasive species eradication. So I'll just quickly kind of describe what the lines are here. So that the top maroon reddish line would represent all of the expenditures made in association with DBW and the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. The next black line representing kind of a Charlie Brown shirt looking thing is our revenues and transfers. So it dips every other year associated with the collection of registration. But we can see here it's been fairly stable over the last 10 years. In 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, 13, you can see on our peaks we're coming very close to our total expenditure lines. In our valleys, we're relying on fund balance to support that higher expenditure line. But what's happened starting in 15-16 is that those two lines have started to separate, and that's caused the fund to become imbalanced, and that leads to the low fund balance that we're seeing now. So we're all very in tune with this, and we're looking at it, and we're trying to understand it first and trying to figure out what's caused these issues with the fund balance. But I think this slide kind of will hint at some of the reasons for that. So what we've seen since 8-9 is a pretty steady increase in other department spending associated probably with the rise of aquatic invasive species eradication. In 13-14, you see a pretty sharp spike in the other departments line. That's when Davis Dalwig came on board, and that's a $10 million expenditure increase to the Harbors and Watercraft Fund. And that actually coincides with the period of time where we started to grow those lines' separation factor. I think it was masked a little bit by a decrease in local assistance in 13-14. You see a dip there. And then we've increased our local assistance in 15-16 and 16-17. So those factors are what I believe are contributing to our imbalance in the fund. So we're going to do things like look at DMV spending, look at food and ag spending, look at fish and wildlife spending, try to really understand what is needed and the nexus back to the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund.
Sorry, just to clarify for those of us who are maybe slower on this. So the green line, which is these other departments, they're drawing out of the fund. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Guys are looking into it?
Yes. Okay. Us, in collaboration with Department of Finance, with the Natural Resources Agency, are all looking into what the spending is used on, what is needed, what is the nexus to Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. So that's all under examination.
And, Will, something I might add, just to make sure that we understand kind of overlying and what the message is that so currently the proposals that you saw Will present previously, that's for the budget that takes effect on July 1st. So that's your 2019-2020 budget. So for budget nerds, that's considered budget year. Overall, what this trend line is showing us is that our overall, that we're spending more than we're taking in annually. And so we've been spending down fund balances. We don't have a problem, if we make no changes, we have no problem in budget year. So the year starting on July 1st. But absent taking some action, we do end up with a problem in budget year plus one. So that would be 2020 and 2021. So while that may seem like, gosh, this is early to be talking about this, in the world of budgeting, this is exactly when you want to talk about it. Because when you explore various proposals, and you're looking at everything, right? You're looking at transfers that are going out, you're looking at expenditures, but also you're taking a hard look at revenues, right? and exploring maybe potential revenue enhancement things. So we're looking at everything, and some things may require statutory changes, and those can come in the form of one of two vehicles. One can be a legislative proposal through a policy bill, and the other can be a trailer bill, which is a bill that changes statute related to a budget. All of those changes are very public, that they're done through the legislature, public discussion. So I just kind of want to get to kind of like brass tacks, that that's really kind of what we're focusing on.
Thank you, Director. Yes, that's important, and I think I left that out, so thank you for adding to the discussion here. So, yes, no problem in budget year, but we are trying to prepare for future years and making sure we're understanding the problems.
As you go through this process, I think on behalf of the voters of California, the question always has to be asked, how is this expenditure benefiting voting, benefiting the voter? In other words, it's easy for somebody to just come up with a, gee, we could get some money from this fund, and this is why. But I think we've always got to ask the question, how is this expenditure a benefit to the voters of California? And the second thing I would ask is, you brought up food and agriculture. I mean, that's a fairly substantial expenditure as I look again at the fund condition statement. And I think you said that it was related to quagga mussel. And I would ask, why then is food and ag, if it's related to quagga mussel, why are they going in and taking this money and not going through the normal process that anyone would for our quagga mussel enforcement and eradication?
All right. So there's a $9, I believe, fee for quagga and zebra mussel eradication that is associated with the registration fee. That is deposited into the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. For state operations, for a department like Food and Agriculture, they're going to go through the normal budget process just as any other department would. So they're not going to receive it as a grant. They're going to receive it as a direct appropriation to their state operations funding. Typically, that's how it works for departments that would be spending out of a fund, such as Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. There's many funds in the state government that are shared between multiple departments. So I wouldn't say that their process is abnormal for state government spending out of this is referred to as a non-governmental cost fund. So they follow the normal process. They go through the Jan 10 budget, subject to legislative review, just like DBW would be to access the Harbors and Watercraft Development Funds.
There were... certain provisions, as I understand it, when the quagga mussel legislation occurred, and who watches to make sure that all of the requirements are being fulfilled? In other words, I think internally our quagga mussel people do a pretty good job of making sure that all the money that goes out through them is audited, is watched, and those provisions, those requirements are fulfilled. How does that occur when it's done the way that this is done?
I can't speak for how CDFA would audit their expenditures or how DBW might audit CDFA expenditures, but I can say that typically there's a front-end process through the appropriation process that would ensure that any proposed expenditures are going to be in line with the use of the fund, and that we're not going to fail Prop 26 tests where we're using fees as a tax. So that is typically done through the legislative review process of the Jan 10 proposals. LAO will weigh in on that. They'll look at the proposals and they'll make sure that the fees are being spent in accordance with the purpose of the fee, so that is resulting in a benefit to the fee payer.
And Mr. Chair, what I might also offer is that it's always subject to the normal audits from, say, the Department of Finance. But that issue also gets caught up in this overall review of the fund. Sometimes what happens in state government with the fund, it's not like the current state of the fund and all of the transfers is a result of everyone coming together for a really thoughtful conversation and thinking about all of the components all at once, right? This fund, like so many programs in the state of California, it's through incremental changes over a very, very long period of time. And sometimes the change is made, the legislative change or the change of law or transfer is made to solve a problem within the context of kind of these facts and these circumstances in the state of California relative to funding and program needs at that moment in time. One of the great things about this review is that we are benefiting from kind of like, for the first time, kind of this holistic, open review of all of these things. So I think you're asking very good questions, but those are absolutely the types of questions that we're going through. And also, I just want to assure you that in the meetings with the Department of Finance, we have made it very clear that everything is about how does this benefit the boater. So we are not the final determination in everything that happens relative to our funding, but we have a very important seat at the table, and we've sensitized them to that. We also, as we went through the public engagement meetings and as we've spent more time at a higher level in this department, in these Boating and Waterways Commission meetings, we realize that that's very important. So I think you're going to see a sensitivity to that, and we are constantly pushing that message forward.
Thank you.
So I think that essentially wraps up my discussion on the 10-year revenues versus expenditures. If there are any other questions on the slide, I'd be happy to respond. Answer.
Any questions from commissioners? I have a couple. And again, I'm a private sector guy, so as I turn to the director always for guidance on how state finance works, because it regularly confuses me. So on a big picture issue, I think you've made it clear that we have two diverging lines that are what I would normally worry about in my business. Sounds like it's a worry here as well, that when our expenditures are exceeding our revenues. And I think as I look at the fund condition statement, those numbers become pretty clear. I mean, I see us going from in the 16-17 time that our revenues were somewhere around $62 million and 18-19 down in the 22, about one-third, and as you pointed out, expenditures, I mean, when I look at the total expenditures at 58 in 16-17, versus 74 in 18-19, that becomes alarming to me, and so I assume that those are things that you're looking at closely, like some of the things we looked at yesterday in regards to loans and grants, that our loan program is virtually flat or non-existent at this point for the last several years, and yet that's a source of revenue for us that we probably aren't even seeing right now. That as we looked at that and we look out 10 years, that's going to be really problematic when that zero is in that particular line item.
Right. So just a couple quick thoughts on those thoughts of yours. So when you're looking at the fund condition, I would just caution, you're seeing a worst-case scenario. One, because in the past year, as I alluded to earlier, we're showing the full expenditure of every appropriation in 17-18, which we know, based on past history, is not going to be the case. We will spend less than our appropriation in 17-18, so that will add to our ending fund balance. Two, with the revenues, we've definitely noticed the same trend that you pointed out. So we're working very closely with finance to understand what is driving any decrease in revenues in 18, 19, 20 associated with motor vehicle fuel account transfers. So that is a very pressing issue to understand. And then three, on the loan interest. So we're receiving about $5 million annually in loan interest right now. Historically, when you look back at the loan interest, we've received around $8 million for the 10 years preceding. I think there were some spikes of $11 million in certain years. So we are receiving, you know, a slightly lesser amount currently, but you know, to the extent we aren't putting out additional loans, that will eventually drop down to zero. So that is another element of the discussion for the overall revenue analysis that we will be embarking on.
Well, I would offer that probably a worst-case scenario look is a positive look today as I look at boating, because as we discussed yesterday and we've discussed previously, prior to 2008, my crystal ball was pretty clear and pretty accurate over the previous 25 years. And since 2008, my crystal ball has really shattered. And so I think boating is really in a period of substantial transition that we don't know where it's going. I think we have to be cautious and look at some of the worst case scenarios, because there is a lot more uncertainty as I look at boating going forward.
Mr. Chair, what I might offer is, I recognize what you're saying. I agree. when you look at the industry. But when he talks about kind of this worst-case scenario, so for those of you that are not as nerdy as Will and I, if you were to actually look at the fund condition statement, so it's the technical document that outlines how the budget, the structure of the budget, and every fund condition in the state of California has a fund condition. So for our fund condition, it would suggest that in budget year plus one, So that in the 2020-2021 budget, that there's a fund balance of like $68,000.
That's in the 1920.
Oh, sorry. So that's in the 1920 budget. So the 2019-2020. That is an extraordinarily low number. So I just want to circle back on what Will was saying about the assumptions that lead to that. So right now, we have not closed our books yet for the current year. So what is the current year? So what the Department of Finance does as they're building the next year's budget when the current year is not closed, they assume that every single dollar appropriated is spent. That never happens. So they go the most conservative route. So they assume that every single dollar appropriated. We know that that's not the case. So as we close the books and as we go through the reconciliation exercise with finance, you're going to see that balance go up. So that is truly the most conservative. However, what you're talking about, Mr. Chair, I think gets into kind of the policy setting, right? And that broader thinking about the fund, not from just a math exercise, but how are the funds that are transferred out to other agencies benefiting boating and users in the state of California? So I think that needs to be kind of home base, right? That always kind of is our touch point that we go back to as we're reviewing the fund. So that there's kind of the math technical exercise, but it really needs to be guided by that, I think, fresh look. So that's what I'm excited about, is that we have this opportunity to have that fresh look and look at everything from that lens at the same time and from today's data points, right? So some of these decisions and some of these transfers and policy discussions happened when things were a little different in both the industry and then the financial circumstances of the state of California. So that's changed, and so we're going to need to figure out policy relative to today's landscape.
And I'd like to, you know, thank you for being there yesterday. I think you heard some of that discussion that may give you that a little more understanding. And as the director said, I think as long as I think it's very positive if we're looking at how, you know, how are all these things benefiting a boater? And because I think the way that boating and waterways was originally conceived was a very positive positive thing, and it was based on how does it benefit the boaters? You know, so I think it's I think that's very helpful, and I appreciate your time yesterday.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I'll just close with a recap of our next steps, and essentially what we've been talking about is assembling a high-level team of representatives from Department of, or Division of Boating and Waterways, State Parks, Natural Resources Agency, and the Department of Finance. And what we're going to do is we're going to analyze our potential solutions to restructure the Harbors and Watercraft Fund in a sustainable manner so we don't have this issue happening 10 years from now. And, of course, using the lens that you've discussed, Chairman, how does this benefit the boaters that pay into the fund? And then we are hoping to have some good recommendations come about in the next several months here, and we'd like to come back in late spring to update the commission on the progress of that team.
Thank you. You stole the words right out of my mouth when I was going to ask you if we were going to see the results of this, because I think this is positive. The directors certainly spent time with me talking about how this is really going to benefit the boating and waterways. So thank you very much, Will.
You're welcome.
Anything further? Any other questions, commissioners? Thanks, Will.
Thank you very much.
That wasn't that painful, was it?
Wasn't as bad, no.
Thanks. With that, I'd like to take about a 10-minute break. I'd like to call our meeting back to order. The next item officially on our agenda is public comment period for items not on the agenda, and I do not have any cards on items not on the agenda. Am I missing any that... then I've... Thanks, Johnny. Okay, first I'd like to call Brad Gross. Brad, welcome. It's been a long time.
Good morning. It has been a long time. I'm Brad Gross, and I am the new executive director for the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains. I used to come to these meetings all the time while I was working through my career, and I retired and then decided I couldn't stay retired, and here I am. And I always said when I came to these meetings it was important to say hello to the commission, get in front of the microphone. It was a great opportunity for us to extend our thanks to Chairman Short for his year, and we hope to see you back very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate it. Jim Gordon.
I'm just going to allow Doug Powell here to introduce what we're going to talk about.
You're both on the list, so whatever.
Well, my name is Doug Powell, and I've been a boating officer for 20 years in the state of California. We're the firsthand users of public boating safety. And what I wanted to talk about today was the regulation that are coming up for the California Boater Card. Jim and I are both on the technical advisory group for the California Boater Card, and we're so happy to have this legislation to get boaters educated in the state of California. Think about it. Just not long ago, you could drink and drive a boat and not have any education, and now we have education. So we're very happy that that's happened. So now there's regulations, and I can tell you in our first year that we've been doing a lot of education in law enforcement. I represent California Boater Safety Officers Association throughout the state, state sheriffs, boating safety officers, and we've seen a lot of education going on. So if we come across people, we're like, this is where you get your education. Are you aware of the card? Matter of fact, I pull my card out, I show it to them. I explain how they can get it. It was just this summer when I came across a boater in Discovery Bay. And they had a child sitting on the front of a pontoon boat, sitting right between the two pontoons out on the front of the boat. My heart stopped because we've taken that accident, and it's tragic. I stopped him. He couldn't get his boat over to the dock, so I boarded his vessel and helped him drive it over there. And I sat there with him for 30 minutes, and I went through page by page of the California ABCs explaining to him the law, educating him. We came to an agreement at the time of this, and he wasn't required to have the boater card yet, but I said, hey, why don't you, his grandchildren also didn't have any life jackets. I said, hey, why don't we terminate your voyage for right now? This is where you can get the education. If you need a book, I'll mail it to you. I'll get it to you. So right now there's a provision such as the termination authority, which is in the provision of the law or in the regulation. This is not a punitive section. This is just a section to say there's an unsafe situation and you should terminate that voyage. You don't have a life jacket for your children. That is the current law now. An unsafe situation where we say, let's go to shore, let's correct this problem, and then we'll continue on. So we kind of jumped the gun. I didn't know that regulations were going to come up yet, and I don't even think it's on the agenda, but I wanted to speak of that from the firsthand user, the boater safety officer. I think it's very important that that section is in there. And if you look under Title 14, it's already there for life jackets, no fire extinguisher, any other unsafe situation where the officer can say, hey, let's correct this. Again, it's non-punitive. It's not a citation. We're just simply telling them, remove your boat to the safe moorage. So that's what I wanted to express. I think it's a great section in the termination authority, and I don't think that we're abusing it, but I think it's a very important piece of this legislation, because why have it if we're just going to let people continue to boat without education? And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. And this is an item on our agenda, so
just a few words on
the ability. Your time to speak here is just fine with me.
So. Okay, just a few words. You know, I'm president of the California Boating Safety Officers Association, with Doug as a member. And as president, you know, my job is to ensure that the members in our association, which is over 400 folks, public safety, including fire and lifeguard and law enforcement statewide, that they have the tools needed in order to promote public safety, ensure the safety of the public on the water, and make their job easier in enforcing the law. And I can't help but think about public outcry if, for some reason, a law enforcement officer attempted to terminate a vessel's ability to be on the water after they didn't have a license, or they weren't educated properly in how to operate a vessel, and for some reason we couldn't ensure that they stay off the water, and they end up harming somebody on the water, and I imagine the public outcry would be great over that. So basically, I'm in support, obviously, of any language that helps give officers their discretion in order to terminate a vessel's operation on the water once somebody's determined not to have a license in their possession.
And again, he was a motor officer, so that's why he says license. But we all know that it's not a license. This is boater education. So when I'm out there in the field and I'm talking to the boaters, I tell them to think of it like this. You have a hunter safety card, you have a boater safety card. And all it is education. And again, not a license, but education. And yes, boating can be fun, and it should be considered fun, but we're the guys that respond when it doesn't end up being fun. And our main goal is not so much the ticket writing, but it's the education. I think maybe 10% result in citations. The other 90% result in education. And that's our approach from law enforcement, and I think that's how we're going to continue to operate while we see this voter card come further up to 2025, where everybody has to have it who's a voter in California. So.
Thank you. I think that we had a discussion yesterday at one of our workshops, and I think there. Obviously, this is a very new thing to boating. And one of the things we talked about yesterday, that as these things are complex, there are lots of scenarios that where this may or may not work. And I know this. I think I made the suggestion yesterday that had the technical advisory group in totality been utilized all the way through the process, from the beginning to end, a lot of these details would have been hashed out beforehand. But the idea of terminating a voyage at 60 miles at sea or 80 miles at sea may not be a practical solution. And so some of these things, I think, had they been talked out in the technical advisory group, could have been worked out and should have been. So, but thank you for your input.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right, we'll move on to the division project report. Casey, you're up.
I'm up. All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, fellow commissioners, director, chief deputy director, acting deputy director, and council. Pleasure to be here. My name is Casey Caldwell. I am a project manager for DBW's Loans and Grants Unit, and today I will be presenting the City of Pittsburgh's request for a $564,000 construction grant from the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund to replace the facility's restroom and to create an ADA path of travel at the Pittsburgh Public Boat Launching Facility located in the City of Pittsburgh. Here to represent the city is its project manager, Sarah Belafronte. And we are here to seek the Boating and Waterways Commission's advice and comment on the proposed grant-funded project. To set the stage, here's an aerial view of the facility's location. To the west is Sassoon Bay, and further west are San Pablo Bay and San Francisco Bay. Nearby to the east are the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin River. Now we're looking at an aerial view of the Pittsburgh Public Boat Launching Facility, and this slide is to orient you to the site. And to be clear, we are not proposing to replace the ramp or the boarding floats or the non-motorized launch area with this project. Instead, we are proposing to demolish and replace the restroom, and to add a safe ADA path of travel between site amenities, including the motorized and non-motorized launch areas. The restrooms can be found at the lower border of this picture at the facility's southern boundary. The motorized launch ramp is nearby, and the non-motorized area is accessible via a sidewalk between those two areas. However, there is no clear safe path of travel between all these amenities, the restrooms, and the parking area. Here is a picture of the existing restroom, which you saw on the tour yesterday. This restroom was originally constructed in 1981, or about 38 years ago, at a cost of about $32,000. The restroom is still functional, but its fixtures are antiquated and deteriorating, as you'll see on the next couple of slides. And these restrooms were designed the same way most restrooms of their era were. Each gender gets a large room with multiple toilet stalls and a shared sink. Modern restroom designs that have one stall and one sink in a lockable room are now commonly preferred in new construction to address privacy and safety concerns. The existing facilities need more than a fresh coat of paint on the floor. The components are functional, but their remaining useful life is very limited. And these are not amenities that will encourage people to explore, use, and return to the facility to continue boating there. So now we're back outside. And this is the view from the front of the restroom building towards the motorized launching ramp. There is a wheelchair ramp in the middle of the curb here that provides access to the existing restroom and to the disabled parking to the left. But that ramp does not feed into a safe path of travel. Instead, it feeds into the corner of the parking lot. And while that immediate location is not accident-prone based on how the flow of traffic is set up, there is still a clear need to establish an ADA-compliant path of travel between all the site's amenities. Briefly, this is the view from the parking lot down to the ramp itself toward the western pilot-guided boarding float. And you can see there is a safety feature here with the yellow bumps on the pavement, but this safety feature is in place to warn drivers of their proximity to the abutment. It's not designed to be a pedestrian path of travel. So here's a simple concept rendering of the proposed changes to the facility. The restroom would be demolished and replaced at the same location with a prefabricated two-stall model. The ADA-compliant path of travel would move from the disabled parking area right next to the restroom, past the restroom, by the southeastern boundary of the facility, in the green shaded area, up towards the motorized launching ramp, and then would turn left and go across the apron to the sidewalk to the non-motorized facility. Here is the cost estimate, which is relatively simple compared to some of DBW's other projects. The slurry seal and striping line is included here in the event that changes to the restroom and path of travel end up impacting the parking lot. We expect those impacts to be minor at most, but we still wanted to plan for the possibility that work might be necessary. Here you can see a few projections about the renovated facility. The city expects it to become more attractive to boaters with the change and for usage to increase over the 20 years following construction of the new restroom and the ADA path of travel. The DBW believes these projections are reasonable. The benefits are expected to exceed costs due to the increased usage. It's worth noting here the facility charges no parking fees or usage fees, so the increased usage itself is the key driver of the overall project benefits in this case. So with all the foregoing in mind, DBW seeks advice and comment on this proposed $564,000 construction grant, Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund construction grant, to the City of Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Public Boat Launching Facility improvements described in the February 7th, 2019 feasibility report. Mr. Chair, thank you. Welcome any questions you have.
Any questions from commissioners? I know that Commissioner Cooley was very impressed with the existing restrooms. He commented three or four times yesterday.
it's like the broken window syndrome. The bathroom just brings in a whole bad element just because it's so nasty.
Agreed, Commissioner.
And I, you know, so getting that out of there, cleaning that up is going to bring in a different clientele or something. It has to.
Glad you agree, Commissioner.
Any other comments, Commissioner Madueño?
No question. They were, with all due respect, they were disgusting.
They were freshly cleaned that morning.
But they were clean. I was going to say, but they smell clean. They did. They smell like Pine Sol. So I thank you because both myself and Commissioner Pettigrew, we used them. But thank you. They were at least clean. So I appreciate that. So a couple of questions. I did see the brochure for the vendor that's going to be doing the fabrication and installation. So I have two questions. I did see the cost. It's $310,000 just for the fabrication and installation. And maybe I'm just having a little bit of some heart palpitations because I'm thinking, my God, my house only cost $269,000. Of course, that was a few years ago, but it's a 3,600 square foot home as opposed to these restroom stalls. So why? I know that there's some components to make it vandalism proof. So is that why it's so expensive? And did you get multiple bids?
So, yes. So it is, most of the cost has to do with the efforts we're putting into making it vandal-proof, safe, and private. The city's, believe it or not, we have lots of parks with restrooms in it, and this restroom is not unique in the way that it's become dilapidated, abused, and whatnot by the public over the years. So we're not just wanting to put in the same restroom. If you'll recall, we submitted for this funding a couple of years ago and actually proposed a different restroom design and company, actually. So, yes, we did receive a few different bids and designs and all that. And since then, we are working on a full program for replacing bathrooms at our parks and public areas in a way that we won't have to be coming back for grant funding in X number of years. So we realize the large upfront cost, but it's got a purpose behind it, meaning, you know, safety, vandal resistant, and all the bells and whistles.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. And, yes, I just want to make sure that we are being good stewards of, mm-hmm. obviously, the public resources. And then this is more of a question, I think, for our legal department as well. And it was a side conversation that I had yesterday with a couple of the commissioners. Where do we stand in terms of, I guess, fulfilling the obligation that the state of California has now put forward in terms of gender-neutral restrooms? Where are we, and how does that factor into our projects? Anybody?
Thing here. That's a new one. So we'll have to check into that. Good question.
Luckily, the design moving forward would be a single stall private, so it wouldn't necessarily be a men's and a woman's. So,
I think staff has a comment, too.
And I will say, Commissioner Madueño, you sound like my partners who are always asking me, how in the world can it cost this much to build a restroom at our marinas? Restrooms are always a very fixture-intensive and therefore costly endeavor. They are always shocking when you compare them to house construction and so on, where you may only have two bathrooms, but yeah. They're incredibly expensive to build.
Commissioner Madueño, really, really good question. And Sarah, her answer was perfect. But if we can have a locking facility, regardless of gender, that provides the privacy for for every individual who uses that facility. So that's why we want to go to one room rather than a communal, as it is. Thank you.
Any other comments from commissioners? If not, I'd entertain a motion.
I think they passed out some brochures yesterday regarding the bathrooms, the different varieties and types, and you showed us the type that you were looking at. Yeah, they look pretty clean and good to me.
They just installed a few in the East Bay along the 680 corridor. I'm forgetting which city, either San Ramon or Danville, and they are highly praised.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I'd entertain a motion to...
I'd like to move that we move forward and approve funding...
Mike.
Oh, sorry.
I'd like to move that we move forward in approving the Pittsburgh Public Boat Launching Facility restrooms.
And I second that.
Moved and seconded. Could we have the roll call, please?
Commissioner Brian Cooley, how do you vote?
Yay.
Yay. Commissioner Brian Cooley. Commissioner David Livingston, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Virginia Madueño, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Commissioner Frank Peralta, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Vice Chair Pettibone, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Chairman Short, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. We have full approval of the commission.
Thank you. That passes unanimously. Thank you
Mr.
very
Chair.
Much.
Thank you.
And with that, we move on. Lisa Fernandez. And the Rio Vista project.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Fernandez, and I'm a project manager with the Division of Boating and Waterways in the Loans and Grants Unit. I am here to present the City of Rio Vista's request for a $1.24 million construction grant for improvements to the Rio Vista Boat Launching Facility. And I'd like to now introduce who's representing the city today, and that is the city manager, Mr. Robert Hickey. We are here to seek the commission's advice and comment on the proposed project. The city of Rio Vista and the project is located in the city of Rio Vista, which is located in the eastern end of Solano County and approximately 44 miles south of Sacramento and just over 60 miles south of San Francisco, southwest of San Francisco. This aerial photo here shows the city, the Sacramento River, and also the iconic Rio Vista Bridge. The city is known as the gateway to the Delta and is surrounded by over 1,000 miles of waterways. The BLF is located on the Sacramento River right in downtown Rio Vista and is popular for recreational boating, fishing, water skiing, jet skiing, and windsurfing. The closest launch facility to this project is Sandy Beach County Park Launch, which is 1.5 miles south of the facility. And this facility was originally constructed back in 1965, utilizing funds from the California Department of Fish and Game. And the commission had the opportunity to see this facility in person during yesterday's tour. As you can see, the facility features a two-lane boat ramp, 30 vehicle trailer parking stalls, pile guided boarding floats, and also a restroom. The restroom was built in 2011 and is ADA accessible and open to the boating public. So this restroom is not part of the proposed improvements. The BLF facility is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and year round. Now shown here is a picture of the boarding floats and part of the concrete ramp. And this was taken during one of our staff site visits in early December, which is during the high tide months, November through February. As you can see, during these events, dry access to the ramp and boarding float is nearly impossible. Here, the existing parking area, pictured here is the facility in an earlier site visit during low tide, where you now can see the apron, abutment, and ramp. This was more like how we saw it yesterday. The existing two-lane boat ramp has deteriorated and has large cracks, which can make it difficult to launch and retrieve vessels. The retaining walls and the boarding floats are failing, and the city states that the boarding floats require significant and ongoing maintenance. The existing parking area is not accessible to people with disabilities and has many cracks and potholes, making it a potential hazard to pedestrian and vehicles. Now here is the proposed project construction plans for the Rio Vista boat launching facilities. And the improvements include replacing the two-lane boat ramp with a new two-lane cast-in-place V-groove boat ramp and a new pile-guided boarding floats, adding a taller abutment with handrails, and this new taller abutment will extend to the top of the apron, and this addition will help extend the availability of the facility. Replacing the concrete retaining walls, the two concrete retaining walls, overlay and stripe the parking area, which will include two ADA vehicle trailer parking spaces and two single vehicle parking spaces. Provide an accessible path of travel for those with disabilities, and move the overhead utilities underground at the entry of the facility, and also to add the site lighting. This table identifies the cost estimate for these improvements. The construction subtotal is $1 million, and the soft cost subtotal is $240,000, bringing the project total to $1.24 million. And this proposed cost estimate is from the city's 95% plans. Now, we estimate that over 7,000 motorized boaters and 1,000 non-motorized boaters would benefit from the improvements annually. And over 160,000 motorized and non-motorized boaters would benefit from the improvements over the 20-year life cycle of the grant. And a common method of financial analysis is to determine the net present value of benefits versus cost. And a ratio exceeding one would be worthy of consideration from a financial perspective. And the benefit-cost ratio for this project is 2.3. So at this time, DBW seeks advice and comment on this proposed $1.24 million Harbors and Watercrafts Revolving Fund Construction Grant to the City of Rio Vista for the Rio Vista boat launching facility improvements described in this February 7, 2019 feasibility report. Now I'd like to ask if you have any questions.
I'll make a comment that certainly was clear to us. I think that the bulkhead was clearly failing and certainly needs help. Any other comments from commissioners? Commissioner Madueño.
Just a quick observation. Right? We briefly touched on it yesterday in terms of how your population growth is somewhat expanding, and I guess it's expanding all over California, but we are seeing more and more migration patterns from Bay Area residents coming closer inland. So I know that your community is no different from some of the others. So I would say, are these some of these estimates pretty conservative? I'm guessing they're conservative in terms of usage.
We actually believe they are conservative. We didn't want to bluster anything. The town is growing at a considerable rate, and if the economy holds up, we could very well see a population of an additional 5,000 within 10 years or less. So we think they're conservative. We're hoping that we're going to get even more usage out of this facility than we have in the documents before you.
And this, just curious, so obviously your community is well known because of the visit many years ago from Humphrey. Has there been any recent sightings of a Humphrey or a relative of Humphrey?
No, but since my office is the building right next there, staff goes out every time that they hear the sirens or they hear a horn, and they go out there and they inspect all the big cargo ships that go underneath, and they have their own whale watching operation underway. So if it is, we will make sure the word gets out.
Excellent. Thank you.
Any other comments? Glad Humphrey had some representation here today. If there are no further comments, and I have no public comments as well, I'd entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion.
Commissioner Pettibone.
Make a motion to approve the grant and for this project.
I second the motion.
Moved and seconded. Could we have the roll call, please?
Commissioner Brian Cooley, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner David Livingston, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Virginia Madueño, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Frank Peralta, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Vice Chair Pettibone, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. And Chairman Short, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Full approval of the commission on the project.
Thanks.
If I may, I'd just like to state I thank you guys for taking time out of your busy schedule to come out and see this project and to see how important it is to the city. I hope that once we get it done, you come back out and see it, and Lucy's will still be there for lunch. And I appreciate the assistance of the staff. Without their support, we wouldn't be here before you right now. So thank you all.
We did have a nice break yesterday in your town and eat at Lucy's, and it was very good food. So thank you for your hospitality yesterday as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, moving on, we have invasive species. I have Eddie Hart on my agenda, but my understanding was he was going to have someone else make the presentation. We have Eddie in person.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, executive staff.
I thought you were delegating. But
Eddie Hart, yes, I'm going to delegate today. That's my prerogative to one of our top staff at the division. And so I'm going to introduce Mr. John O'Brien. He's our pest control advisor and our floating aquatic vegetation control lead. So John O'Brien.
Morning. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Aquatic Invasive Plant Control Program. So this just this is a picture of the West Side Canal. This is in the Old River area. It's a site we've been actively harvesting for the past, not just this area, but for the past 2 months or so. This is towards the federal fish facility. So I think we all know in this room, Boating and Waterways is the lead agency in cooperating with federal, state, and local entities to control aquatic invasive plant species in the Delta. There are 9 species we can control. The big ones, obviously, are water hyacinth and Brazilian waterweed, Aguirre densa. The first two in the picture, Uruguayan water primrose, has become more of an issue over time, and we can talk a little bit more about that. We had a new weed species, floating invasive species, put on our list. We put it on the list in 2018, alligator weed. This is a major aquatic invasive species in the southeast. It's from the Amazon basin. It just showed up in the Delta in 2017. And so we've been working on an active early detection rapid response program to take care of this species. So this aquatic invasive plant control program, we control and manage invasive species in the Delta for environment, economy, and public health. So environment, endangered species, wildlife species, economy, obviously your marinas, shipping channels, that type of thing, and then public health. That is especially mosquito vector control. We do all of our work in coordination, as we all know in this room, I think, with our federal nexus, USDA ARS. That's the Department of Agriculture Research Station. It's a control program, not an eradication program. However, with alligator weed, we're actually hoping to eradicate it. And we'll see what happens there. And it is a permissive program. It's not mandatory. So what that means, we have a menagerie of permits we have to get in order to do the work. If we don't have that, we can't do the work. And if there's no funding, that kind of thing, we can't do it as well. And just to give you a sense of exactly what we're talking about, we all know the Delta proper. You know, we can see Sacramento kind of toward the top, going down to the Manteca area. That's legal Delta. We know that. But we also work going west into Sassoon Marsh, and then south all the way to Fresno down the San Joaquin River. The southernmost areas in Merced, Fresno areas, we actually contract that work out to local ag commissioner offices. So this is a kind of a Trivial Pursuit type puzzle there. This is just to give you a sense of the permits that we need in order to do the work. So the big thing in the middle, we've got the biological opinions, ESA's Endangered Species Act. This is the, we work to do this with our federal regulators. This is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA National Marine Fisheries Service. So we need to have a biological opinion from both of those entities. We've got an updated one from National Marine Fisheries Service, I'll say NMFS henceforth, and we've been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for a new one. We'll get into the whole consultation process here in a little bit. And then there are many other, obviously CEQA, the endangered, environmental impact report going around. We've got to be in compliance with the Delta Plan. LSAA is Lake and Stream Bed Alteration Agreement. We're kind of going to the left. MPDS is the Clean Water Act work that we have to do. We've got a NEPA, I'm jumping over to the green one, NEPA environmental assessment. And then below that, we've got the Rivers and Harbor Act and the ITP, that's the Incidental Take Permit, and that's with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The ITP and the Rivers and Harbor Act are two new permits that we're working on this year.
Excuse me, is NEPA a new requirement? Is that because are you working on federal lands then? Is that
That's as part of the Rivers and Harbor Act, and so that's something that we've done recently.
That is a new?
Yes.
Environmental requirement. Yes. Okay, thank you.
So moving forward, leveraging partnerships, and this is one of the big ways we're able to have, I believe, an effective program, and that's working with all the different entities that are involved. And so the federal, agriculture, commerce is NOAA, interior, the reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Homeland Security, Coast Guard, Army Corps, NASA, multiple state agencies, obviously the different Delta Protection, Delta Stewardship, Delta Conservancy, those different entities, and then local entities as well, agriculture commissioners, local reclamation districts, marina owners, different businesses in the Delta. So working with all those, and with everyone having a seat at the table, we're really able to make sure that our program is working for all the different entities involved and all the different stakeholders. So this is just to give you a sense of our current integrated control strategy, and then we've been working on the consultation program process for an updated one that we started this year, and then we're going to be going henceforth with. So historically, we've done a lot of herbicide treatments. The picture in kind of the middle of the top, you can see us spraying some hyacinth there. Bottom left, you can see, this is what we use to do the fluoridone treatments, and that's for the Egeria densa. But then we've done a lot of harvesting in the past. That's something that we continue to do. We're hoping to do less of that in the future, although that will always be a tool, especially in areas when you have a real dense infestation. Physical removal, top right, that's something that we don't do as much of anymore, and we're hoping to do less of in the future. So as I mentioned, with the biological opinions through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NMFS, we've starting in 2013, having a five-year biological opinion to do the work we need to do. And before that, we were doing a year-to-year type thing, and that would push back when we could do treatments, can we do treatments at all. And so this five-year period really helps us and I think helps everyone involved. That being said, 2018 has been when the last consultation was done in 2013, it ends in 2018. And so starting in 2016, we've been working on a new consultation. And this just gives you a sense of the process. I've only been involved in this process kind of on the side, but this has been going on since 2016. We've been doing plan and research, drafting a program description, meeting with the regulators, that's Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, researching the effects of our different treatments, coming up with a BA, biological assessment, and then giving that to the National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for review. And so we've gotten the biological opinion, and we're doing the annual planning for the National Marine Fisheries Service biological opinion, and we're still working with Fish and Wildlife Service to get that biological opinion. We actually just had a meeting with them yesterday. So it's quite a long process, and we can talk more about that, and Eddie can really give, people want in-depth, gory details about this process. They can ask him. Yes?
I don't need in-depth, but just with the five-year, and obviously you have to start 2 years ahead of time, what happens if there's a delay by one of these other agencies? Does it seize all actions, or can you continue on an emergency, permit, I guess, so to speak?
Yes. If, for example, we haven't gotten the new U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've given us an extension. And so for 2018, we were operating under an extension of that permit. And then with that extension, they gave us a few additional things. We asked for a few additional things that we could try for this year. So it doesn't seize all action, but if without the biological opinion and then without the extension, it would. So, but we had a meeting with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service yesterday, and we're actively working to get the new one. But if we don't get the new one, we'll be operating under an extension for this year. So, yeah. So this slide just gives you a sense of what the future integrated control strategy will be. You know, we'll still obviously be doing herbicide treatments. We'll still be doing harvesting. Again, we're hoping to do less of that going into the future. And then the big one that we've added is the biological control, and that's working with our federal nexus, the USDA ARS, Department of Agriculture Ag Research Station. So this picture at the bottom is Patrick Moran, Dr. Patrick Moran, and this is us in answer to Commissioner Pettibone's question. We were allowed to do the biological control releases starting this year, and so this is us. We did about 20 different sites this year. And so we were releasing a plant hopper specifically for water hyacinth. So that's part of kind of, and then as well, physical removal. I'm still hoping we do very little and we do even less. And then physical controls is another thing we're hoping to do this year. This is something that we have not gotten approval to do yet. And that includes putting booms, curtains, trying to slow down flows in places where we're having hard times doing the treatments. But we cannot do the physical controls currently. So just to give, this gives an idea of the 2019 programmatic approach. The first one is developing a single consultation for plant control for the whole program. So in the past, there was the water hyacinth control program, there was the Egeria densa control program, all of these different control programs it was species focused, and now we're moving towards an aquatic invasive plant control program. So it's one consultation for all the species, all nine species. Also increasing coordination with the regulatory agencies. We actually had a meeting several weeks ago with the federal agencies that were working at that point. There were some contractors there and otherwise, and talking about our plan for the coming year. And we worked with this integrating an operational management plan, an OMP. I'll talk more about that in the next slide. But basically having a really detailed plan about what we're going to do year to year and presenting that with the federal regulators and getting their input, not only the federal regulators but also the different stakeholders, so different state agencies. Optimizing efficiency and environmental protection, that's something we're always, especially starting now, trying to make sure the treatments we do are effective, making sure that we're treating at the right time in the right place. We're focusing on the areas that need to be treating using what we need to do to get the best results. And in doing that, the hope is that we're actually, by hitting it at the right time, we're actually reducing the number of times we need to go in there in the future, thereby protecting the environment. And then operationalizing performance monitoring and adaptive management, and we'll talk more about that in other slides. So the operation management plan, the OMP, this is something that we're going to be doing on an annual basis, and that's prioritizing the areas we need to treat, having that at the beginning of the season and then showing that to the different stakeholders and getting their input into the plan. And of course, you know, as part of adaptive management, we may need to do a shift and prioritize another area, but this gives us a plan going into the season. Also, monitoring protocols, we'll talk more about that. Conservation and avoidance measures for different endangered species. And this operation management plan is a requirement, actually, of the National Marine Fisheries Service biological opinion. Actions in the OMP must be covered in the biological opinion incidental take statement. And this, the diagram on the right, it's a little more confusing to talk about. I really like the one on the left, talking about planning, doing, and evaluating and responding. And that's something that we're really starting to work on a lot more closely now. We've always done a certain level of planning, a lot of doing. We work hard out there, but then evaluating and responding as well. You know, while we're let's come up with a plan for the season. Of course, we may have to change that depending on conditions. Let's get the work done. As we're working, let's look at what we're doing and let's evaluate and respond. Do we need our rates off? Do we need to go in there a second time? Do we need to hit that earlier? You know, looking at those things, evaluating and responding. And that's really an important part of what we're starting to do and what we're going to do in the future. And this just talking about the performance metrics again, this gives an indication of that. So for the Floating Aquatic Vegetation Program, we have been working with NASA to get this basically spatial imagery that gives us a sense of percent cover. It can really give us an idea of where problem areas are. So the picture on the left shows the southernmost portion of the Cache Slough complex. You know, you can see the kind of all the reddish black on the right. That's Prospect Island. That's one of the Department of Water Resources Eco Restore areas, and that really shows that it's heavy with floating aquatic vegetation. And so that's an area where we're going to need to be doing more work. And then as well, that gives us a sense of kind of where there's heavy vegetation, but it doesn't necessarily tell us what's there. Is it pennywort? Is it primrose? And so that's where doing this point intercept sampling from boat will help us get to that. So using NASA to give us a sense of, okay, how much vegetation is there, using the point intercept method to give us a sense of, okay, well, now we know there's a lot here. What is there, actually? And then photo monitoring as well, kind of over time. We've initiated starting last year, 2018, three times during the season, getting pictures at various points in the delta, and that just gives us a sense of the change over time. And then for the submerged aquatic vegetation program, these are some things that we've been doing and will continue to do. That's using the sonar on the boats to map how dense the vegetation is under the water. We do this for all the treatment sites, and then doing rake pulls to get a sense of what actually is growing there. So there have been many publication successes this past year. We co-authored a poster on integrated pest management. We've done multiple presentations, Western Aquatic Plant Management and many, many others, down to California Weed Science Society just a few weeks ago. We funded research for a published work for Aquatic Toxicology Journal, and then have submitted manuscripts for the Aquatic Invasions of Frank's Track Success Story. And there have been many collaboration successes. We have been working with the interagency IEP, the Interagency Ecological Program, on the work we've been doing in the Delta. And then as well partnering with Department of Water Resources for their Eco Restore Program. We've been doing the invasive plant work for that. Working with the Corps of Engineers and Coast Guard for improving physical methods. And then collaborations with the Delta Plan. And as the Delta Plan compliance, we have received certification of consistency from the Delta Stewardship Council. They have asked for enhanced adaptive management that we've talked about, and then rigorous performance measurements and monitoring. And we've talked about that as well. That's something that we're actively adapting or integrating. And then integrated Delta as a place through the AIPCP operations. So where do we fit in terms of the agriculture, cultural, and natural resources and recreation? So the rooster out there told me that my time's up. So with that, I'll answer any questions or comments that people may have.
I'm a little worried because I think that was my wife's rooster has followed me down here. But, any questions from commissioners? Your excellent presentation.
Thank you.
It's what you do is very complex and requires a lot of communication. Getting down into the weeds, no pun intended. When you're actually out on the water, how do you communicate?
Each of the scientific staff and then the field staff have a cell phone that a state issues cell phone, and so we stay in communication that way. And when we're getting on and off the water, we'll generally send text messages, hey, I'm on the water, hey, I'm getting off the water. We've also been starting to use handheld radios for communication, but the cell phone is definitely the primary mode of communication when we're out there.
And your handhelds, are those marine radios?
I believe so. It's a walkie-talkie, but honestly, I don't know the specifics of that. And we've used it some, especially when we were trying some of the submerged aquatic treatments that we were doing later in the season with some new herbicides we've been using. We really utilize those handheld units. But I don't know the specifics about that, but the cell phones are definitely, the state-issued cell phones are generally what we use.
I mean, I'm thinking from, that there's a lot of law enforcement out there, San Joaquin County, Contra Costa County, et cetera, Sacramento County, and your ability to communicate with law enforcement while you're out there, is that something that you... Apparently, you're going to get superseded here by the boss.
Mr. Chairman, pursuant to our visit yesterday to the San Joaquin County Sheriff's Office at the River Point Landing, one of the things that the department is working on with the division is furnishing all of our vehicles and vessels with marine radios. And the Law Enforcement Emergency Services Division of the department is facilitating that with the Acting Deputy Director. So we will have, in addition to the cell phone, which there's oftentimes black holes in the Delta.
I would think.
The PUC is aware of that, and they're working on broadband services and so on. This will be the stopgap, because one of the things we were talking about with the deputies yesterday were utilizing channel, was it 16, I believe,
if we need to.
And that's something we don't have at our avail at this point. So that's moving forth, and hopefully we'll have that before May.
Good. Some of that discussion was surprising to me, that boating and waterways would have boats on the water that did not have marine radios on board.
We're coming to the 21st century.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Eddie, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any other comments from commissioners? Thank you very much for a very excellent presentation. With that, we move on to Ron.
Yes.
You're gonna talk to us about abandoned vessels, surrendered vessels, et cetera.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners, Chairman Short. Again, my name is Ron Ken, and I'm here, and I'm a program manager for the Surrendered and Abandoned Vessel Exchange Program, which we call SAVE, and I'm here to report on fiscal year 2018. Yesterday, you guys had a reorganization workshop, and I think it was discussed that this program is now part of the grants and loans section of Boating and Waterways. I'd like to let you know that all the photos you see today will be of vessels that were removed in 2018 under this program. Yesterday we were at San Joaquin Sheriff's Department, and Deputy Silva talked about the issue that they have in the Delta. The issue is abandoned vessels. Abandoned vessels pose an environmental hazard as well as a navigational hazard. And the SAVE program assists local public agencies in removing these hazards. The funding also assists these agencies for accepting vessels from owners who want to turn in vessels that they no longer want. The SAVE grant funding comes from the Abandoned Watercraft Abatement Fund, which we call AWAF. So SAVE is a combination of two separate programs, the Abandoned Watercraft Abatement Fund, which we, again, AWAF, and the Vessel Turn-In Program, which we call VTIP. So agencies used to apply for these grants separately and use the money separately. SAVE allows them to apply for one grant and use the funding as they need it. This makes for more efficient use of the funding in removing boats from the waterways. These are some stats from 2018. The grants are two-year grants, so that's why you see three up there. 16 expired in fiscal year 18, and then, of course, 18 became an active grant. DVW does a workshop to promote grant awareness. Last year, this workshop was very successful. We cover grant management. We assist agencies with the online grant application, which we call OLGA, on Monday, this last Monday, February 4th. We announced through a press release for SAVE 19 grant application cycle is open. In that press release, we announced that the workshop will be March 5th. It will be held here at DBW offices. Again, we'll cover grant management. We'll cover how to apply for the grant. And the agencies have until April 30th to submit their grants. Go ahead.
Question on the workshop. If you have folks that can't get here in person, is it online? Can they do it, log in, see it? Or for folks who are logistically challenged, what do you do for them?
I don't believe it's like a webinar type. It's not webinar that I know of. I think we've done that in the past, but we haven't done it. I know we didn't do it last year, and I know we didn't talk about it doing it this year, but it's something we could do. I know that when the grant application, when the press release goes out, my email address is on there, and I get lots of emails initially. And so I spend a lot of time over the next few months helping these people. If they've never done this before, I walk through them how to register their agency, how to register their grant, the person that fills out the grant, and then help them get started. And if they have any other questions as they're going along there, I give them my phone number. They call me back, and I help them out at that point. So if it answers your question, no, it's not online. It's not webinar. So this concludes my presentation. I do have a guest speaker. After he's done speaking, if you guys have any more questions, we'll field questions then. At this time, I'd like to introduce Lieutenant Cook from the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department.
Good morning, commissioners and directors. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today and talk a little bit. I wanted to come today to offer a little bit of perspective from those of us who are down on the waterways removing these boats and tell you a little bit about what the SAVE program means to us. As I'm sure you all know, but just to kind of lay the foundation for the discussion, Contra Costa County, we have over 250 miles of linear shoreline jurisdiction. We lie on the San Francisco Bay, the San Pablo Bay, the Suisun Bay, and the Sacramento and San Joaquin River deltas. So these waterways represent a significant economic, ecological, sporting, and recreation resource for us. And as such, Sheriff Livingston maintains a very robust marine services unit and takes our stewardship of the waterways very seriously. Because of that, we've participated in the SAVE program and before that, the AWAF and VTIP program since their inceptions. I'm very glad that Ron brought the pictures with him today and that periodically we look at these pictures to remind ourselves that if at some point we choose to if at some point we lack the resources or the willpower to maintain our vigilance on caring for our waterways, the result is that those boats will not be removed. They'll litter our the waterways of the state as they have in the past prior to being addressed by this board and the Division of Boating and Waterways. I'm going to check my note here so I don't mess up my numbers, but just to give you an idea, in Contra Costa County, we consider ourselves a leader in the Delta for caring for those waterways and for removing abandoned vessels. In the last, I'm going to say the 2017 grant cycle, we applied for two rounds of funding. The first one was for $200,000. The second one was for $109,000, and we expended all of those funds over the life of the grant. The result of that expenditure was that we removed 62 abandoned watercrafts and 94 vessel turn-ins that otherwise could have remained littering our waterways and polluting them with hazardous materials and creating hazard navigation and making it much more difficult for the people of California to enjoy them for boating and recreation and the economy. I think it's important to note that we actually had more vessel turn-ins than we had AWAFs or abandoned watercraft removals. And the reason that to me is important to note is because through the public outreach and information campaigns of the Division of Boating and Waterways and through word of mouth in the boating communities, the word has gotten out that you can turn in a vessel and we'll help you take care of it instead of allowing it to go to the waterways where otherwise it would create a problem. That's significant because where it could cost me anywhere from $30,000 to $80,000 to have a vessel pulled off the bottom of the Delta and properly disposed of, I can do the same thing for a couple $1,000s if the person is forthright and comes to us and asks us for assistance up front. So I just wanted to take a couple minutes of your time to thank you for the funding and the resources to take care of our waterways and to let you know that those of us that are on the waterways doing the work recognize it and appreciate it and value the cooperation and the partnership. Thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions? Commissioner.
Yeah, just a quick one. On the vessel turn-in, did were some of the turn-ins from harbor operators, or were they all just individuals that turned their boats in?
So it tends to be a little bit of a balancing act. We don't want to be the fail-safe for harbor operators who don't want to who allow derelict boats to stay on their property. But we also don't want to allow those boats to sink in place and pollute the environment, right? So we work with the harbor operators to make sure they're fulfilling their responsibility to operate a responsible business, but not let damage occur that would become costly. So some of them, I guess in response to your question, some of them do come from harbors, but we try to be judicious about how we address that.
That brings up an interesting point that when we talked to the deputies yesterday, I think it's important to understand that about 80% of the boats in the state of California that are stored in the water are stored in public marinas that are privately operated. And it was a collaborative effort when we went after this, creating this fund, and it was important that within the legislation was the authorization that the abandoned boats out of public marinas that are privately operated be able to be taken care of, because that is 80% of the boats that are stored. So I'm a little concerned when I hear the discussion about the responsibility of the marina operator. I think it's important that this is a huge benefit to the people of California, that any boat, whether it's some individual coming to law enforcement and turning in that boat, or whether it's coming out of a marina, whether it's publicly operated or privately operated, I think it's important that we recognize what we're trying to do is keep a boat from being abandoned. And so I think it's important that law enforcement works with the private sector to make sure that those abandoned boats don't end up in our waterways, and that program continues to be available to 100% of the boaters in the state of California. I think that's an important factor. Any other comments? I will say they grow them big in Contra Costa County. Thank you very much for your Thank presentation. You. And with that, I have a public comment card. Kevin Ketchum. Kevin, thanks for jumping on an airplane and coming to our meeting today.
Thank you. I flew all this way for the California boating card, but I couldn't help myself on this item. Kevin Ketchum, this hat is California Yacht Marina. We're one of the larger coastal marine operators in California. As we all know, vessels are aging, and this is a great program. I want to thank the division of staff for providing something that is really needed. Frustration is, though, on the private sector side, because of systemic laws or how the state is structured, the private sector cannot avail itself to this program. In theory, we can avail ourselves to it through the agency we find ourselves operating within their jurisdiction, but in practice, very few participate in the grant, want to go through the brain damage of helping the private sector with it. For example, Port of San Diego, which is 30,000 boats are sitting there in their harbor, their bay. They do avail themselves to the funds. Their grant was, I think, $20,000 here recently. They're applying those funds for they have an issue where vessels are being moored, banned on the backside, outside of the jetty in Coronado. I think one of those pictures may have been one of those vessels. But that's it. Great Attitude has discussion, didn't know it was on your agenda just 2 days ago with the person on the port who's responsible for that program. Their cost is $16,000 a vessel. $20,000 grant doesn't get them very far, does it? So they've got years of a backlog, and talking to them about, well, why don't you go for more money? The grant's there. If your issue is $200,000, then why don't you apply for a grant? So I think this boater education, if you could send the Port of San Diego, that would be helpful, because they, I think there's a disconnect. This is a great program, and they didn't know what it was. But there, just so you know, in San Diego, if you want to turn your boat in, there's no one to turn it into. If you're the privates, if you're an individual boater, if you're a marina who legally has gotten title through a lien and all those things, you can't avail yourself to this program. And what happens is they end up like the pictures you see. So I want to thank you for the program, but point out that maybe when you do rulemaking on these type of grants, maybe you can start thinking about how can we encourage the public agency side to work with the private sector. Maybe they need to, when they report to you, maybe they have to explain what their outreach program was, what they have actually done. Get some more feedback how they're interacting, because as the chairman pointed out, the vast majority of all the vessels are not sitting in public agencies' facilities. That's the truth. But thank you for the program. It is a very good program.
Kevin, thank you very much for your input. I think that is a, I think it's an important subject, and you know, when you look at the purpose of the legislation, keeping abandoned boats out of our waterways, certainly the Delta, I mean, Contra Costa County, Sheriff Livingston, you've certainly availed yourself of the program and are aggressive in your in what you do. But I don't think that that, I think Kevin is right, that, that there needs to be, we need to be out there making sure that we're reaching all of the, availing this program, giving the opportunity for all boaters in California to access this program, no matter where they come from. So, thank you.
Lieutenant Cook wanted to say something more, if that's okay.
Of course.
I apologize. Just so I can clarify, so our goal, in we work with all of our marinas, and we have very good relationships with all of our marinas. 2 days ago, my guys were patrolling one of the marinas and saw an oil sheen behind a boat and made the appropriate notifications and tagged the boat to let the owner know. Our goal is more to work with the marinas and responsible ownership to make sure that owners of the vessels are the first resource to take care of problems, so that we're working with the marine owners, the boat owners, and ourselves to resolve the problem, not just to be good stewards of the public funds. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Commissioner Pettibone.
I'm quite sure I've been told the answer to this, but if somebody abandons a boat, it's like any abandoning a car in a, on the road or in public. I mean, it's a crime, right? It's polluting, right?
If we can. It's oftentimes kind of a blood from a stone kind of a proposition. The people that are abandoning the boats are difficult to locate. They're transient in nature. Many of them, for the boats that you see, are drug users who fail to care for the boat, or the boats have been stripped of their hen. And if they have outboards, then the serial numbers don't help us, and they're difficult to track down and locate. We take all reasonable means and efforts to contact the owner and get them to take care of the problem themselves. But I'm sad to say that more often than not, it does not result in our ability to levy a criminal fine or recover funds.
So encouraging the turn-in is a really positive.
The turn-in thing. Program is vastly preferable to the AWAF program. We have the AWAF program is a fail-safe, right? It gives us the opportunity to clean up things that have gone wrong. But yeah, absolutely, sir. We would prefer to get those boats beforehand, and we bend over backwards to help get boats from people. And we take boats from any of the surrounding counties. If somebody calls us and says, I have a boat I want to turn in, we make every effort to help them turn that boat in and make sure it doesn't end up on the waterways. We'll trailer it. We'll help them tow it.
Yeah, it seems to me, having been in the industry now for more than 30 years, I think collectively we need to work on getting the word out. And I'm surprised at what Kevin made us aware of, that there isn't any place for anybody to turn one in the Port of San Diego. That's pretty surprising, since it's one of the most significant water bodies in the state of California, that program doesn't, the boaters there aren't, that program really isn't available to them.
I agree that it's a very valuable program. I apologize. I'm not familiar with San Diego and would have a hard time speaking to it, but I can tell you that the Division of Boating Waterways does their dead level best to get the word out. And it's a matter of marketing. And once the word starts to catch and people start to talk about it and they call local marinas, I know San Joaquin in Sacramento, if somebody calls them and says, hey, I have a boat I'd like to turn in, and if they're low on save funds for that year, they'll say, hey, if you call Contra Costa, they'll help you out, and we work together to make sure that the boats end up where they're supposed to go.
I think that we probably could do a better job of getting that word out through the private sector as well. I mean, I'm sure that the marina operators would be willing to send out information to their boaters, making them aware of this program. So I think that's something that hopefully we can talk about at staff and look to getting that information out, maybe through our communications department? And
so, Mr. Chair, in the past, we have we have developed a brochure on the vessel turn-in program. And I know while we're out at marinas that those brochures are available out there. So if we welcome any other ideas that you could have, but we are out there in also spreading the word when we attend or at the Harbor Master Park Captains. I know you mentioned private, but I know in Karen's area when they're also out there on working on the boat launch facilities, we're also spreading the word on our other grant programs.
Thank you. Commissioner Pettibone.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest maybe it might be good to think about doing a presentation with the League of Cities and CSAC, as well as the special districts, because obviously they're kind of the clearinghouse for all the areas throughout the state, and it might be a good way to present it to make sure they're also hearing it from you guys directly instead of also, you know, hitting it from the top down versus locally.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Thank you. I was just going to add that our communications and marketing division has done wonderful things with social media over the last couple of years and really sort of elevated the department's messaging, including boating. So I think that we will go back to them and talk with them more about, you know, maybe some strategy around social media messaging that they can help us with to get the word out as well. Another avenue.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Sure. And Ron, thank you for the presentation. With that, we'll move on to Joanne. She's going to talk to us about our law enforcement financial aid program.
All right. Good morning. My name is Joanna Andrade. I'm the program administrator for the Subvention Program and the Boating Safety Enforcement Equipment Grant Program. I last informed you of these programs at the February Commission meeting in 2018. I'd like to start my presentation with an overview and update of the Subvention Program. As you heard yesterday at the workshop, this program is now part of the Law Enforcement and Emergency Services Unit. The purpose of the Subvention Program is to provide local government agencies whose waterways have high usage by transient boaters and an insufficient tax base to fully support a boating safety and enforcement program. The program is not intended to fully fund the agencies, but it is intended to augment their local resources. Participation in the program is entirely voluntarily, and an agency can opt out at any time. The division supports local law enforcement agencies in supervising on-the-water activities, enforcing state and local laws, and conducting search and rescue operations, as well as providing education and outreach to the public. The division does reimburse the agencies for salaries and benefits and operational costs. Listed here are a few of the statistics the division collects from the performance activity report, which is required annually by the participating agencies. These statistics help to support the importance and impact of the program and the need for law enforcement on our waterways. So, counties spent over $27 million in this program in 2017-18. The division supported $11.5 million in funding to the participating local enforcement agencies. The difference is covered by the participating agencies' county general fund and boat taxes. The amount exceeded from 16-17 was approximately $1 million. There are 40 local law enforcement agencies that participate in this program. This is made up of 38 counties and 2 cities. Yesterday, we toured areas throughout the Delta. I have listed the agencies throughout the Delta that participate in the program and their allocated amounts provided by the division annually. A full list can be found on our division website. The division participates in events such as Operation Drywater, which is a nationwide event that occurs annually around the 4th of July weekend. The purpose of the event is to raise awareness about the dangers of boating under the influence. We also participate in events such as Delta Blitz, where the Delta agencies work together on busy holiday weekends to enforce state and local laws and educate the public about boating safety. The division also partners with associations such as California State Sheriff's Association, Boating Subcommittee, the California Boating Safety Officers Association, the Delta Officers Intelligence Team, and the Colorado River Law Enforcement Association. Our goals for fiscal year 18-19 are to continue to conduct another workshop for our subvention partners, as well as any new partners, and to continue to conduct site visits. Okay. Now I would like to provide you with an update of the Boating Safety and Enforcement Equipment Grant Program. As you heard yesterday at the workshop, this program is now a part of the Grants and Loan Unit. The purpose of the program is to provide grants to local government agencies to purchase boating safety and enforcement equipment. The funding of the grant comes from the Recreational Boating Safety Program that the division receives from the U.S. Coast Guard Homeland Security. Some examples of equipment we fund are vessels, personal watercrafts and trailers, dive gears, and repowers and motors. In 17-18, we completed grants for 7 patrol boats, 4 sonar equipments, 1 remotely operated vehicle, dive gear, repowers, and vessel repairs, as well as miscellaneous marine patrol equipment. So here's pictures of equipment and dive gear. This is the 5th year that the Boating Safety and Enforcement Equipment Grant is available through the online grant application process, which we refer to as OLGA. The application is currently open and will close on April 30th. The division will be conducting workshops on March 5th and March 8th. The workshops will cover how to apply for grants, scoring criteria, tips on application process, reimbursements, annual reports, and requirements of a federal pass-through. Notification of these workshops went out through email and press release. I did want to touch on workshops to address your question earlier, Katie. So we have done in the past like a Blue Jeans conference, from my understanding, from a prior person who handled the program. It didn't... wasn't as successful, so we went to like a conference call, and I personally have found that this way of doing the workshop is more impactful. It allows us to have that one-on-one communication and face-to-face, and then we also are always available one-on-one. If somebody cannot make the workshop, we're always there to help if needed.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Joanna.
Yeah.
All right, can I also add on that we're also looking at multiple workshops in the future as well. So if someone isn't able to make one, that they can also they attend another one.
I think it's extraordinary that the staff is willing to do one-on-one. I know it's a time. I mean, that's the thing is I worry about your guys' time. So you had somebody who couldn't make it, and they said, oh, it's in Sacramento. I can't get there. I don't know how to do it. Therefore, I'm not going to do it. And to be efficient with technology, I mean, I had a conference call this morning that involved webinar and it's just the way a lot of people are doing things now.
Absolutely.
We want to use your guys' time wisely.
Thank you.
Hi. Oh, go ahead, Karen. Sorry. Karen Dill, I'm new chief of the program, and as we combine all of these grant programs together, one of the things that we're looking at as far as efficiencies goes is combining all of the workshops for all of the grants and have multiple locations at different times, as well as moving forward as technology improves. We've tried other technological resources, but as we move forward, getting things online, using YouTube, using webinars, using all this so that grantees anywhere can get the resources to be able to take advantage of this funding. So that's where we're going. We're not there yet, but that's the direction we're headed. Thanks.
Accomplishments and goals. So we continue to tag new equipment with the state park tags, and we add that into our inventory system, which we refer to as Maximo. Our goals are to train staff as this program transitions to the grants and loan unit. We will continue to plan program workshops based upon participants' feedback of the workshop. We will make revisions to future workshops to improve and this important training. We will continue to conduct site visits to ensure equipment is being utilized and maintained. So now I'm going to show a video. This is a boat that Contra Costa County Sheriff did receive through their equipment grant last year, and then I'm going to have Lieutenant Cook come up and speak.
That's a guy that knows where he's going.
So now I'd like to turn it over to Lieutenant Cook from Contra Costa County Sheriff to talk a little bit more about the boat. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm back. Thank you very much for having me again. And I'd like to thank the gentleman who did the invasive aquatic species for laying the groundwork for my presentation. As you are aware, much of the jurisdiction that we cover in Contra Costa County is inundation land from former broken levees, shallow water swamps around Sherman Island, Big Break, Frank's Track, Little Frank's. These areas are not safely accessible by traditional patrol vessels. And in the past, the people who work for me have employed methods that I wouldn't suggest, but are ingenious in the way they try to get to the people who find themselves stranded in these circumstances that they can't get out of. In the past, we have used traditional patrol boats and trimmed the motors all the way up and used push poles. We have also used PWCs, which resulted in the operator having to take off his equipment, dismount, pull the weeds out of the intake, jump back on, go a little further, jump off, pull the weeds out. But the simple fact is the people that we were moving towards were in need of rescue, and we have the responsibility to get to them and to deliver them to safety. We have had officers also disrobe, jump into the water, and swim rescue lines to boats that were in need. One of the gentlemen that works for me, the gentleman that was driving the boat in that video, saw this as a vast gap in providing public safety, because all of the methods that I described a moment ago create a greater danger for my personnel and delay the safe rescue of the people who are in trouble. So he started looking into solutions, and what he found was that people in Louisiana have been doing what we needed to do for generations. And he tapped into that resource and put together a grant application, which the Division of Boating and Waterways was gracious enough to grant. And we put out a bid and worked with a vendor in Louisiana who built this particular boat. This boat is a vital resource to us to be able to access people who find themselves in trouble in circumstances that traditional boats just won't allow us to access safely and timely. And so we appreciate that grant. It was purchased partially with our county funds and partially with the Division of Boating Waterway funds. And it's going to be an immense resource for us. And if I may touch on a side note real quick, on the first part of her presentation, and the workshops. As an end user, I've used their workshops, and you have a great staff in the Division of Boating and Waterways between Ramona and Karina and Joanna and Ron. They're constantly accessible, always willing to answer questions, and incredibly patient with those of us who come into the position we're in with a high level of ignorance and a great level of need. So thank you very much for that. Do you have any questions about our new vessel?
Well, we didn't get to see the power. Is it an airboat?
So no, sir. Yeah, that's a good point. I apologize. No, it is not an airboat. It is powered by twin air-cooled 40-horsepower Briggs & Stratton engines. The gentleman who owns the company and designed this boat, as I understand it, designed the drive system as part of a master's thesis when he was in college, and it turned into a business for him, and he had several patents on the straight drive. So in a traditional outboard engine, like the 300s we generally use for most of our boats, it has a lower transmission system. And when you hit fixed objects, the gears in there tend to strip and break, and that's where we end up with propeller damage and transmission damage and things like that. This one is much more robust. It takes all that out, and the speed is controlled a lot more with the trim of the engine. And how much bite you're giving the propellers into the water, and is just run by a belt system to a shaft, taking out all the smaller moving parts that tend to fail when you're in circumstances like that. So instead of getting tied up in the weeds, it just powers through them. It
So it's another method of mechanically removing hyacinth and so on.
It is effective at that. One of my guys calls it the salad maker.
Thank you very much for
that.
Thank
you, sir. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions?
Commissioners, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joanne, for your presentation.
Thank you.
And with that, we move on to the only controversial issue of the day. Pardon me? I don't think it's going to go that long.
Okay, good morning, commissioners. My name is Evan Becker, and I am the program analyst for the California Butter Card Program. As you heard yesterday in your workshop, the California Butter Card Program is now part of the Interpretation and Education Division within California State Parks. Today I'll be giving you an update on year one of the program, as well as discussing our program goals and objectives for 2019. At the beginning of 2018, DBW began issuing cards to the public. We received over 23,000 applications and issued over 19,000 cards. During this time, we accepted NASBA-approved certificates dated between January 1, 2015 through December 31, 2017. As of January 1st of 2019, we are no longer accepting certificates dated prior to 2018. So this graph shows voter card activity over the past year. The blue bar represents the number of applications received, and the gold bar represents how many cards were issued. The reason there are fewer cards issued every month than applications submitted is largely due to the delay between when applications are submitted and when boaters complete their boating safety course. As you can see from this chart, we had significantly fewer boater card applications since July. We believe this trend is a function of the boating season ending, early adopters from other age groups taking initiative to apply for their card early, and the reduction of social media advertising until regulations could be completed. We expect to see applications increase significantly over this year as boating season approaches, regulations are finalized, and the new age group is targeted with online advertising as their phase-in date approaches. With this being the first year of implementation, everyone 20 years of age and younger were required to possess a boater card if they wanted to operate any motorized vessel on state waters. 26% of cards issued were to those that were 20 years of age and younger. 79% of cards issued were to males, and 21% were to female. There were 9 course providers that were approved in 2018. As you can see here, the top 3 courses taken were through Boat US, Boat Ed, and DBW. 30% of boaters took the free Boat US online course, 28% took Boat Ed's online course, and 21% took DBW's free home study course. Almost 3/4 of all boaters took one of the online course options. 21% took DBW's home study course, and 8% decided to take a classroom or on-the-water course. So this map shows all states where California boater cards were mailed to. As you can see in blue, we sent a boater card to all but 9 states throughout the United States. There were also cards issued to many countries around the world. Some of those countries include Canada, Germany, Switzerland, Singapore, Australia, United Kingdom, Austria, and France. At the beginning of 2018, we began program advertisement for the year, notifying boaters of the new law and who is required to possess a California boater card. We worked with DBW's ad agency, Uncommon, to create social media posts, print and digital ads, marina posters, and radio and TV ads. We had over 6 million social media impressions and over 200,000 print impressions. With the help of the iHeartMedia Street Team, DBW participated in 83 event days promoting the California Boater Card. We participated in boat shows, outdoor shows, county fairs, and state fairs. We had approximately 12,000 one-on-one interactions with boaters, distributed over 20,000 flyers, and over 5,000 home study courses. So this picture is from the 2018 Fred Hall show in Long Beach, where we met a boater who already had his boater card. We were also at the Los Angeles Boat Show this last month and met over a dozen boaters who were proud to show us that they had already gotten their card. So So this past year, the California Boater Card website was visited over 250,000 times, with the majority of boaters viewing our website on a mobile device. With that statistic, we have recently updated our website to be more mobile-friendly, making it much easier for the boater to navigate through. Throughout 2018, we received input and questions from boaters, which helped us with the redesign of the website. As you can see here, the top four most viewed pages are listed for you to choose from, simplifying it for the end user. This shows you what the website looks like on a computer and on a mobile device. And this went live in January of this year. We began writing regulations for the program in December of 2016. The notice of proposed rulemaking documents were posted to DBW website on December 14th, 2018, with the comment period ending on January 28th, 2019. Like we mentioned earlier, there will be a public hearing on those regulations later today at DBW headquarters, which is located at 1 Capitol Mall, Suite 400, from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Our main goal for 2019 is to finalize the program regulations. Once our regulations are approved, we plan to continue all advertisement for the boater card. We are required by Senate Bill 941 to post our first legislative report in April of this year, stating the total number of cards issued, fees collected, costs incurred, violations, and the accidents, injuries, and fatalities correlated. We will also be distributing another flyer insert in all boater registrations this year as well. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions of commissioners? Seeing none, I know we have some comment cards, and thank you for pointing out that the meeting this afternoon, the really official meeting is this afternoon at 3 o'clock, because of the process that has to occur, it was felt that we couldn't do it here at this meeting, but I appreciate those of you that showed up, because I think obviously at 3 o'clock that meeting won't be televised, where your comments are important, and since this is televised, more people will have the opportunity to then hear and participate in this discussion. So with that, I'd call on Brad Gross.
Hello, Chairman Short, Commissioners. Brad Gross, Executive Director for the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains. But that's not why I'm here for this. I'm actually the immediate past chair of the Association of Marine Industries. And they're based in Rhode Island, but they cover the United States. And they've asked me to present this letter, and I'd like to read it. I gave one to your clerk for the record. I'm sorry I didn't bring enough for the an entire commission, but if I could just read this to you very quickly. It's addressed to Randy Short, Chair of Boating and Waterways, from Eric Kretsch, Legislative Coordinator, Association of Marine Industries. AMI is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to serving the needs of the marine industry. We're a diverse membership of 1,000 marinas, yacht clubs, public-private moorage basins, partner associations, and marine industry vendors and suppliers from across the United States, both inland and marine, including 60 members in California. The U.S. marina industry accounts for $11.8 billion in economic impact, which supports 105,000 full and part-time jobs in California alone. There are estimated 1,200 marinas supporting $1.5 billion in economic activity. Additionally, these marinas support an estimated 350,000 slips and 1.1 million boaters who access the waters of California via marina facilities. I'm writing to comment on the proposed regulations concerning the California Boater Card. As you may know, Senate Bill 941 provided for the establishment of the Boater Card in 2014. SB 941 sufficiently balances the need for educating vessel operators on boat safety and vessel operation while not imposing an inordinate burden that would serve as a barrier to the entry into boating. The current proposed regulation section 8200.6 violation allows law enforcement officers to terminate the voyage of a vessel if it finds the operator does not carry a boater card in their possession at the time that they are stopped. This rule effectively takes the voter card and turns it into a voting license, which is counter to the original intent of SB 941. Additionally, the violation imposes a greater burden on operators and serves as a barrier to entry. It is our understanding that harbor officers under the Harbor Navigation Code, Section 6550.5, already have the authority to terminate the operation of a vessel if it is found to be unsafe for operation or is being operated in a reckless or hazardous manner. We suggest, as our other partnering organizations have, that a more pertinent action would be to give the operators a chance to complete the required educational course before a fine or a citation is levied. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm available to the commission.
Thank you. Kevin Ketchum.
Again, thank you, Chairman, Commissioners, Director. I have three hats. I've got a marina operator in Southern California. I'm actually on the technical advisory group for the CARD. And a past president of Marine Wreck Association, which representatives would have been here, but their annual big training board, planning board, is down in San Diego, and they couldn't be here. First of all, let me say to staff, phenomenal job in promoting there. You cannot go anywhere without knowing you've got to have a card. With these groups I'm associated with, I was part of the legislative group that worked with establishing the bill and the goals and the accomplishments. So when I get the proposed rulemaking, obviously from being a TAG member, I'm interested. And I'm going through it, and you know, it's easier to criticize than to create. So there's some language I would have done different, and I'm working through it. And then I get to the violation section. And out of left field, I'm going, where did this come from? It's so contrary to the evolution of the bill, the passage of the bill, the discussions in the TAG group. For the record, the bill does call for violations. $100, $250 for the second violation, $500, and the court dictates that violator has to get a card. The bill already calls for violations. Bill does not contemplate, does not reference, does not suggest that a termination of a voyage would be an appropriate remedy. Canada has their boating card program. They have their fines. They don't have a termination of voyage. Washington, which was used, the state of Washington, which we used as a template to help California establish this, they have the fines. They don't have a termination. And keep in mind, it's very complex because there's exemptions. So if you're out of state, but if you're out of state, you can't be in state more than 60 days. If you're out of the country, you don't have to have a card as long as you haven't been here for 90 days. Well, what this is proposing to do is now law enforcement makes the determination, are they here legally or not, right? Are they in compliance with the card? And then they implement the remedy. And that's not our system. The bill already calls for a system where a citation is given, right? You can go to the court. If I had my card, keep in mind, 20 years from now, the card I got yesterday is the same card I have. There's no requirement to go to another training session or every 5 years do this, do that. It's very simple. I haven't used my boat in 3 years. I got my family. I'm on a lake. And all of a sudden, I don't have my card with me. I'm in violation. And that trip, that vacation, that boating experience is now terminated. That wasn't the intent. I'm in the coastal ocean. I'm coming down from Canada. I come into the California waters. Okay. Well, yes, I'm supposed to have a Canadian card, so now the law enforcement, I need to prove that, yes. So now that we're putting the burden on the law enforcement officer, she needs to know the laws in foreign countries, because the bill requires, if they require a card, you got to have it. and states. Does Arkansas require a card or not? Does Nevada? Does Oregon? Does Washington? We know it does, right? So problematically, there's an issue. But there is a remedy. And the remedy is there's a fine. And that's the way it should be. That gives me the chance. I had a card, and the bill provides I can mail in proof I got a card. If I was in the state for more than 60 days or I wasn't, I can prove those things and then get relief. If I'm in violation, I get hammered with a fine, and I still have to get the card, and I got a court now making me do it. The bill worked through these things. To terminate a voyage, as Brad referred to, is inconsistent with trying to encourage safe boating. And keep in mind, the article, the bill, it's called Education and Certification Card. And the example that Doug gave with the person who was not boating safely, correct? That individual wasn't required to have a card. And as Brad indicated, law enforcement still has on the books, if someone is violating the laws on safe boating, that trip can be terminated, right? That person wasn't required to have a card. And conversely, if that person had a card, doing something so ridiculous as that, right? There's other provisions to terminate. Does he not terminate because he had a card? Keep in mind, there's no driving skill test with a car. It's not like your driver's license, right? You don't have to prove you can drive. What the intent was is the state, the agencies, and those associations who are responsible for dealing with recreational boating want to have people on the waters who are educated. Okay? Encourage safe boating. I think, Chairman, you're suggesting this probably could have been a tag issue. It's something that perhaps could have been fleshed out, because what happens in life, with best of intentions, we all are myopic to our only little view of the world, right? There's over 800,000 registered boats, CF boats, in California. I think we used a number of 1.5 million potential cardholders. They have all different types of experiences in California waterway. Okay, this violation may work to send someone to shore if they just came off a boat ramp and they're local, but it's not going to work in other situations in California. So I strongly suggest, and I don't know the processes and how state government works, but I suggest we stay with the violation as called for in the bill. And by the way, in April of 23 and in April of 28, the bill provides the agency, the division, to make recommendations to change the bill. So the bill already incorporates your ability to analyze it. Hey, the bill should have this. It shouldn't have had that. Make adjustments. And if in that point in time someone thinks the violation should be a termination, there's a good cause for it, that is the time to have that discussion, not slip it in as a rulemaking. And I understand I was on the tag. I'm engaged. And out of left field, damn, where did that come from? So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it. Andrea Luker.
I was hoping to say good morning, but now I'm going to say good afternoon. I'm Andrea Luker. I'm the vice president of the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains. And we've prepared some remarks today that, unfortunately, I'm going to read to you instead of doing an animated presentation. So we represent over 70 harbors and marinas, both public and private, throughout the state, and work closely with our boaters on a day-to-day basis. We're certainly committed to making our marinas and harbors safe environments for all boaters who navigate our waters. Today, we'd like to address our concerns with the proposed regulations regarding the California Boater Card. We applaud Senator Monning for the passage of SB 941, which created the California Vessel Operator Card, known as the California Boater Card, in 2014. I want to emphasize the word card because it was never intended to be a license. I brought with me a copy of the Senate floor analysis on the bill on Senate Bill 941 for your review, and let me read an important section of this analysis for you. SB 941 strikes a good balance between ensuring that vessel operators are sufficiently educated on boating safety and vessel operation without imposing excessive burden, which would serve as a barrier to entry and harm this critical aspect of our state's economy. Along with our colleagues, we share the same concerns on Section 8200.6, entitled Violation. If a vessel is stopped by a law enforcement officer for suspected violation of any provision of law, and the operator cannot provide the evidence of a valid California boater card or proof of an exemption to processing a California boater card, the law enforcement officer may require the operator to terminate the voyage by removing their vessel to the shore or to a safe moorage or anchorage, or transferring control of the vessel to a person legally authorized to operate the vessel. Those proposed violations are inconsistent with the intent of SB 941 and infers that the California boater card is a boater license, which it is not. Furthermore, the violations are imposing a greater burden that would serve as a barrier to operating a vessel. Our harbor officers already have the authority to terminate the operation of a vessel if it is found to be unsafe for the operation pursuant to the Harbor and Navigation Code Section 6550.5, and it's primarily used if a harbor officer finds a vessel operator to be reckless or hazardous to those around or is impaired by alcohol. Harbor officers have the authority to stop the vessel and remove an operator, which is a misdemeanor in the court of law. Rounding up, officers do not need additional authority to pursue to ensure public safety in our harbors, although we agree that there should be some recourse for those not having a California boater card. We believe a more appropriate course of action would be to allow the harbor officer the discretion to give the vessel operator a warning which requires they obtain a California boater card by issuing a citation or immediately removing them from the vessel, removing them from a vessel. For the reasons stated above, we insist that the Department of Parks and Recreation reconsider these proposed regulations and specifically remove Section 8200.6 violations from the proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Jerry Desmond. Jerry, I assume you're representing RBOC, is that correct?
Thank you, yes, sure. You know, Chair and members, Jerry Desmond, here on behalf of Recreational Boaters of California, or RBOC, and most of you know who we are, but we're a nonprofit advocacy organization. I think we're in our 51st year, and we have 80,000 boating families who belong to 170 boating, sailing, and yachting clubs throughout Northern and Southern California. And we've been involved in the issue of certification, licensure, or education for probably 35 years. You go all the way back to some proposals in the 80s for licensure of boaters. And like my colleagues who spoke before me, you know, RBOC was a very active participant in what developed into SB 941 in the state legislature. And we were strong supporters of that legislation. And we're strong advocates for the full implementation with a robust boater operator education card and certificate as envisioned by the division and as being implemented. We're very strong supporters of that. And we have our past president, Greg Gibeson, who's a member of the TAG along with Kevin. And when we came into the negotiations for SB 941, the three key provisions that our boating community had for our support for the measure were that A, that this program would be implemented and administered by the Department of Boating and Waterways, the division, rather than DMV, because there were thoughts at the time that DMV could do all this. The second was that whatever was going to be the fee to be charged to the boater for the card be reasonable and cover the cost of the program and not be a separate revenue generator, because we knew we wanted acceptance amongst the boating community. And the third is that it'd be an education initiative and not a license. And so by education initiative, you see that was what we found in our community is that the great support for the concept of a boater education card was be that it meant that the other person on the waterways had some basic education. And we said, well, you know, many of us have been boating for 20, 30 years. We've never had a violation. We're safe. Why do we have to get this? Why do we have to get this certificate? Well, it meant the other person out there has gotten that education. And that was the concept that sold it with our community, because it meant everybody's educated, so we're safer. We'll go through that if it's phased in over time. And so in the legislation, we also, I think with others, purposely asked that Senator Monning and Senator DeSaunier at the time include provisions that talked about a ramp-up of the program over years, an assessment of the program together with the division and the stakeholder community in that tag. So what was referenced as a, you know, an initial report coming out in April, that's Harbors Navigation Code 678.9, purposely there so it could be evaluated, could be, you know, even has in that statutory text, what's the correlation between cards and accidents and injury? How's it working? How's it being accepted? The word's not out on the street that you're going to get, if you get pulled over and you don't have a card, you know, that you're going to be taken to shore. That's not out there in the community. You know, a second is that there would be a review and a recommendation to the legislature has been referenced. It's on April 1, 2023, and every 5 years thereafter. And that's supposed to include what are the recommendations to change the program. Many stakeholders may have changes. When we were involved, we didn't get everything we wanted in the boat as the boating community into SB 941. We didn't get, and there was a lot of discussion, might come up in a recommendation, but what we, and it has to do with the rentals and the education program for rentals. But what we decided is, let's go through the path established by the statute. Let's go through the door of getting everybody educated, and then let's see how it's working. So in our view, this is contrary to that. And the specific code section that talks about the fines is Harbors Navigation Code 678.15. First offense, 100, second, 250, third, 500, and the court is required to take the person convicted of the infraction, that within 7 months they got to take and pass a course and get a certificate. It's required of the court. It's not optional with the court right there. And then I'll go to the specific provision itself that, I guess if you look at it in the regulation, there could be a good question as whether the statutory references for the authority to have this section 8200.6 are actually there, because the cited laws are the laws enacted by SB 941. But none of those laws say that the regulations must give, you know, must address the ability to remove, have a vessel operator stop operating their vessel and take it to shore or hand it over to another operator. Instead, you know, the regulation says that it's very broad authority to law enforcement. And some of the words that are used is that if a law enforcement stops a vessel for a suspected violation of any law, it doesn't say of the SB 941 enacted law. It says any law. There are a lot of laws out there. And then the person has to show evidence of a card or that they're exempt, and the authority is to terminate the voyage and have the boat brought, the vessel brought to shore. And that could be for any violation of law. And so we think it's also overly broad and not tailored to what I think we're hearing from the law enforcement community that is well-intentioned and is an important stakeholder and part of making this work. So in the big, in the final big picture, this is an education intended to be an education program in terms of our support for the laws that are enacted. We think the robust rollout that is occurring through the regulations and the card and the social media and getting the acceptance of the boating community to get these cards is a phase that will be challenged. We think will be challenged, and if the word gets out, because it hasn't gotten out, that there would be a potential regulation that would provide this kind of authority and make it a license. And so we urge consideration be given to these. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. Appreciate that. And that concludes the public comments. I think it was important to the official meeting is at 3 o'clock at DBW headquarters. But I thought it was appropriate, and I think having listened now, I think it's important that this got out to the broader public. And so thank you, gentlemen, for making the time to come here and comment. Any further comments from the commission? Seeing none, we'll move on to our last item on the agenda, which is the election of officers. And I would open that with open for nominations for chairman. Commissioner Cooley.
Mr. Chair, I would nominate Commissioner Virginia Madaria for chair.
Commissioner Madueño.
So, thank you very much for the nomination. I will only accept the nomination if we can all do a real quick run in pronouncing the last name Madueño.
you mean there's an Inye in there somewhere?
Thank you. Are there any other nominations?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any other nominations? Hearing none, do we need a roll call?
Yes, Commissioner.
If you could do the roll call, please.
Okay, on the nomination of Commissioner Virginia Madueño to become the next chair of the Boating and Waterways Commission, Commissioner Brian Cooley, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner David Livingston, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Virginia Madueño, how do you vote?
I have a comment first.
Yes.
Before I say anything or approve or unapprove or rescind, I just want to go on record to say, you know, I stand here as somebody who didn't grow up in boating, and I've learned a lot in the last 4 years. I am not going to pretend to be something that I am not. However, my commitment to all of you, especially those of you who are in the industry, my commitment to you is to fulfill this role with the utmost of integrity, and that I will learn. And true story, when I did get the call from the governor's office, I did say, I am not the most qualified for this position in the traditional sense. I am not a boater. I don't know very much about boating, and I don't know much about recreational water. And truth be known, I have a pool in my backyard that measures 5 feet. I'm 5'6", and I almost drowned 2 years ago. True story. But what I did tell, and my commitment to the governor and my commitment to Secretary Laird, was that I would learn and that I would always make sure that I would take the best interest of the community and ensure the protection of the resources that we allocate to ensure that we, again, meet the most profound, if you will, of requirements and necessities to improve this industry. And I look forward to serving with the rest of all of my fellow commissioners. So thank you for that nomination, and I will accept. Or yay.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Commissioner Frank Peralta, how do you vote?
Without a doubt, aye.
Aye. Thank you very much. And Vice Chair Pettibone, how do you vote?
Aye.
And Chair Short, how do you vote?
Aye.
So you have the full approval of the commission to be the next chair of the California Division of Boating and Waterways Commission. Congratulations, Chair Madueño.
Thank you.
I would now open nominations for vice chair, and I'm going to take the opportunity to nominate Commissioner Cooley.
I will second that nomination.
Any other comments, any other recommendations? With that, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Chair Short. For the nomination of vice chair, for Commissioner Brian Cooley to take that office, Commissioner Cooley, how do you vote?
I would accept the nomination as long as you can pronounce my last name correctly. and I vote yay.
Commissioner Cooley, aye. Commissioner David Livingston, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. The new chair, Chair Madueño, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Commissioner Frank Peralta, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Vice Chair Pettibone, how do you vote?
Aye.
Current Chair Short, how do you vote?
Aye, and I will say that on Commissioner Cooley's behalf, he is a boater, surrounded by water 24/7.
Well, with the full approval of the commission, we have the new vice chair of the California Division of Boating and Waterways Commission, Commissioner Vice Chair Brian Cooley. Welcome.
With that, are there any suggested agenda items for the next meeting? Commissioner Pettibone.
I believe we will have representatives from Long Beach area on to present on the 2028 Olympics plans and where they're at. So I think they said they'd make the next one, and we'll confirm with them as we get closer.
Thank you. And just to follow up on a discussion that Commissioner Pettibone and I had, it would seem that appropriate that Boating and Waterways would actively support the Olympics, and that we may need to really look at how our funding would work. How would we be able to, what are the mechanics necessary for us to provide funding for some of the boating venues that may be necessary? I'm off the top of my head, I'm always reminded that we usually look at the life expectancy of 20 years for our grants and so on, and that it may not be appropriate in an Olympic venue, but I think it is appropriate for Boating and Waterways to support the Olympics. And so I think maybe we need to start projecting and thinking what do we need to do to allow us to facilitate that. So, any other items for the agenda? With that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. We do not need a roll call. We are adjourned. Thank you.